The call with our dear angel Sue setting the tone and getting us started for this wonderful Thursday night. So, Angel Sue, pass the talking stick to you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Marita Robert. And to all of you, we welcome you in the light of the Most Radiant One and in the office of the Christ and only in the office of the Christ. And we're invoking the loving energies of Saint Germain and the Violet Flame here now. And so as we're gathering together, we need to put a little extra focus on sharing energy and light with Penny and Lynn, her husband up in Canada. Lynn's having some extreme health challenges at this time. We also know that many are suffering through. And I know, Tara, you say suffering is only an option that we don't have to choose, but it sure is the default. And many, even my mama Harriet, is going through some painful things this evening. So whatever these are, let's ask and intend that all these sweet beings, all these sweet people, and those that we know of and those that we don't, receive extra calibration and balancing this evening and as long as they need it. We're choosing ourselves again and reminding ourselves that we are the divine children of the universe. And so if you will call in your support team, and this is your higher self and your twin flame, your guides, your masters, your teachers, your angels, your councils of light, and all those from the lighted realms that celebrate your path here. Just by you being here and using your choice to fill yourself up with gratitude. That's one of the most powerful things we can do. So whatever comes, we can rejoice that the perfect solution comes forward. And we'll use the law of one on that in just a little bit. But I'd like you to first check on you. Look on the inside. Just for a few seconds, go from the top of your head down to the bottom of your feet and intend that a calibration occurs, that what can be given comes from the great central sun and forms a tube of light with you inside, and that this light is balancing besides calibrating, and that what can be released is sent down to the center of Mother Earth, to that cobalt blue sun, and that the energies are sent back with many blessings and enter in an arc of above, I should say, first your head and your shoulders, and come back down to right below your shoulder blades into the body. Combines with that light. And we're just going to praise, respect, thank, and love the perfect original divine blueprint being released yet again within ourselves. That your divine path, that your joy body, that your love be expanded and magnified, that your mental and emotional selves will find the most amazing peace, and that the expansion of light within, around, just transmute all. It flows out across the earth and that phases or flashes, I should say, of light is coming from the planet, and it's being added to by all beings of light. And that more and more light accumulates, and we'll find that perfect, happy, divine solution happening for ourselves. And so with this, we're going to take in a peace breath. Fill up those lungs, and then on the exhalation, say the word peace and find one of your happiest, most wonderful memories, whether as a child or as an adult. And peace, let it magnify and anchor in every cell and every atom and intend that wonderful feeling stays with you as long as you need it. Then we're going to think about the people that we choose in our lives as our family and our family itself, our associates, people that we're aware of. We're going to choose to celebrate Lynn. We're going to choose to celebrate all those that we're aware of that are going through challenges physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, financially, all aspects. And we're going to praise, respect, thank, and love what they are adding to this world, to our understanding, and to the energies, teaching above and beyond our understanding. And with this praise, respect, thanks, and love, we're calling on the masters, the avatars, the angels, to lift this up so they have their perfect, happy, divine solution for all aspects. We're calling it in for Nasara, the Reformation Act. We're calling it in for our Faction 3 White Knights and our Divine Forces of Light, Galactic Forces of Light. And with this, also we're going to add on the Law of One. And so with this original Law of Creation, we're going to welcome in all the beings tied in with us, with our concerns, with our family, our friends, and everything, every condition, every situation. And we'll even pull in all time and space. For we are all one. And when one is harmed, then all are harmed, and as one is helped, then all are helped. And therefore, in the name of who we are, and we are one with all there is, we ask that only the highest good of all concerned happen here. And we call for heaven on earth now. And so with this, keep it going. Do a good job. Make it even more wonderful, more beautiful, more better and gooder than we can imagine. Miracles, we call in miracles. And so we are closing now by saying all men, all women, all children, all beings, all creation, we are all one. And we're rejoicing that all is being done in the best way possible. So thank you for that. I pass the talking stick back to you, Marita Robert.
Well, thank you so much, Angel Sue. We appreciate you and put you in the circle of healing as well with your mama. Caroline, are you with us here? I know that you were having a little trouble getting connected earlier, but we would like to have you share with us what's going on in the Mayan calendar this week and anything else that you may want to contribute.
Well, thank you, Marita. Yes, I'm online finally. And it is a blue lunar night. So we're looking at a 2 Oxball and the new wave that we started yesterday during that portal day. It was also a portal day in the Mayan calendar as well. And so we started the new wave of Eek, and that's that wind energy and visionary aspect. So be open to listen to the mind of spirit in this wave. And so here today we're doing that dance with two Akbal and that two lunar energy and Akbal the night. So I'll share with you the affirmation of the day. It's, I polarize in order to dream. I stabilize intuition. I feel the input of abundance with the lunar tone of challenge. I am guided by the power of vision. That means it's guided by man, the eagle. So that is the guiding tone of the day. And so then tomorrow we have a three con, the seed. And con is that, well, let's talk about three first, that cadence, electric, activation, energy, movement, and current are the essences of this tone. So activation. And then con energy is the seed. It's a healing energy, and it's about openness to life and self-determination, about harmony seeking and timing. It's gifts of possibility and that potential of creation. So it's a good time to let go of stagnation and then lack of self-confidence. So that's tomorrow's energy with calm and that three activation. So plant those seeds. And then on Saturday, we have a four Qichang, that serpent energy, the warrior. It's a warrior aspect, and it's about remaining open to change. And, you know, as this wave is deep, you know it's all about the winds of change and the wind. And so we've got that carrying through with that Qichang energy and the tone of, it's a four, stabilizing, self-existing. So adding some grounding to that energy. And then on Sunday, it's a five kini, that linker of worlds, and five energy. It's one of the pillars in the way, so this energy is strong. And so we do that, have that extra boom with that linking of worlds, kini energy on Sunday, the warrior, forgiveness, world bridger, and that five tone of centered movement, that overtone, spectral, working with those energies. That's Sunday, and then on Monday we have a six Monique, that healing hand, the deer energy, healing self and others, doing that with that six tone, that rhythm, that tone of equality. So, yeah, the healer of humankind, the ability to open new doors, acceptance of the divinity itself. Good energy on Monday, and then on Tuesday at 7 Lamont, the Stargate, and that powerful 7 energy. So good day to work with that portal that Lamont brings us, and that powerful energy of 7 at the same time. That channeling, resonance, inspire, attainment. Those are catchwords for 7 in Lamont, the Stargate. It's a visionary aspect and about the illumination of humankind. Good day on Tuesday. And then on Wednesday at 8 Maluk, we revisit that way we just completed with the moon energy. There's still a lot of moon energy around. So Wednesday on the 8 tone, fine-tuning, harmonic resonance, galactic resonance. It's a galactic frequency. And Maluk, that artist energy, wise use of rational mind and accepting spirit's direction. So, and that we have that gift of contacting spirit with that moon energy as well. So use those energies and do your work from Wednesday, and then on Thursday when we come back, it'll be a 9-0 expanded cycle with unconditional love of the dog. Oh. So there you go. I just noticed Friday is the 13th. The Friday the 13th, and that's a 3-con. So we have that fun little Mother's Day energy going there tomorrow. So enjoy that. Other than that, there are no portal days this week whatsoever in terms of the seasonal days that we talk about. So it's all pretty straight up. And that's good because we have a lot to integrate. We've got a new moon we're working with. So, and in beginning this new wave with the working with the wind energy and listening to the mind of spirit that way. So there you go. That's all I have for this week. And so I'll pass this talking stick back to you, Marita. I have nothing else on the agenda.
Talk about wind energy. We've had 50 mile an hour winds here all day. It started last night, and it is just as windy as we ever have it here. So it's been, when you talked about wind energy, I thought, well, that's right on. So
yeah, and it's happening here as well. There were a really strong wind.
So. Uh-huh. Well, cleaning out the place, maybe. All the negative, that's just, ask that all the negative energy be taken out with all this wind, and we have peace afterwards. So, well, this evening, Tara and Rama are going to give us some information about what's going on in the world and, excuse me, and who they've talked to. And then the second hour, we have Tara and Rama have two different 40-minute things that are very educational and very informative and fit together, and they're going to use both of those. So we're going to do that during our guest hour tonight, so you know that it's a little different format than sometimes, so it may not be quite on the hour when we shift and change. They're in charge of that. So, Rama, did you talk to anybody out there, and what do you want to share with us tonight?
OMG. Oh, my God. What we are watching.
Oh, just want to remind everybody, please make a contribution so that we can support Stargate Roundtable. This is us, and take some time. I just ask everyone to take some time and surround our brother Lynn and this situation and all the family. I'm so grateful, Angel Sue. Thank you for what you do. I just want to second
thank you,
the motion.
Angel Sue.
And we all love everyone. Okay, nothing is out of place. It's just a time for all of us to embrace the greater reality at the moment. And that indeed it is.
The times, they are a-changing. And what I have heard today goes into the realm where 38 levels, I think, above the president disappears. And
what does that mean?
That little article I printed out for you over there.
Which one?
Edward Snowden.
But what do you mean it disappears, the 38th level? I mean, it...
Well, what I mean is that there are these black projects that don't exist, and they're called unacknowledged special access programs, and the president, Congress, Joint Chiefs of Staff, nobody gets to know except these strange characters I kind of talk to, and that's just the beginning. And then it goes into the realm where E.T. Cory goes in, and all these other stories about the Secret Space Command, and what we haven't been told about how billions of dollars disappear into these black projects, and this goes into the sci-fi movies that are not just a joke. It's pretty scary, awful stuff they're creating, yet I already have, you know, heard it from the Admiral and the Captain themselves. The nukes have been neutralized. What they're playing with is this real dangerous brinkmanship game on a need basis.
Yeah, and Rachel is talking about that kind of stuff right now on her show.
Yes. And I talked to Tom, Larry, Curley, and Catherine, and what they told me is that as you were to see the side of government, as we all are employees of the government, so to speak, yet those ABC agencies have no name, no address, and they're only three letters. It's kind of like the Men in Black, only a lot more scary and a lot worse. Yet this is where something has happened since the last blood moon and even before that, where so many galactics have already walked into these areas.
I got to stop you. I just saw a ship. I just saw a ship on Rachel's show just now in the stuff that they're talking about. It says Kurds launch offensive to retake. But in the footage where they're showing that thing go off, right in front of it, there was a ship. I saw it with my eyes.
They can't hide it any longer. And this is,
in other words, the ship was right there where the explosion was going on.
Yeah.
So they were probably beaming people out of harm's way.
This is like, you know, the point these folks are telling me that I talked to. We are on that extreme edge of full disclosure. The powers that were are trying to hold the curtain back, as, you know, it's said about, you know, the little Wizard of Oz, and Toto pulls the curtain back, yet the whole world is pulling the curtain back because the 13 families are broke. They can't keep up with what beloved ascended Master Saint Germain is doing to change the story right now.
Yeah, but the trouble with that is that, for instance, on DW News, they were talking about being at this Malta summit. It's the African-European Malta summit.
Yeah.
And they're talking about giving
a pittance.
Something billion dollars to the African countries to defray refugees that have risked their lives and died by the thousands going across the Mediterranean to come to the European continent. And they're deporting thousands and thousands of them that lived back where they came from. And the African leaders just were outraged. They said, there's no way. There's nowhere near. That's nothing. It's not enough to handle. And thinking that these people can get a job. There are no jobs.
We have to create a new way of being. And this is how I'm being told, as Dr. Cash's technology gets out there. Other folks are coming forward with other forms of generators, working with crystalline energy, and it's all leaking out. They can't stop it now. And gas is back down. Now it's $1.95 in Santa Fe.
It was almost, how much was it?
It went back up to $2.09. And then it dropped down now to 195.
Is that the lowest it's been? I thought
yes.
It was down lower. No.
No.
Okay. Well,
Rama,
Dr.
I have a question here from Commander Randy. Please ask Rama if the story surrounding the green-blue light over L.A. is the result of a galactic operation destroying an under-ocean base of a Draco genetics lab that produced parts for the elite clones.
That's possible.
That's entirely possible, yet I haven't heard that. What I heard was that was a portal that opened, and there are all kinds of craft coming in. This conjuncts with what Natasha...
Yeah, but they would be coming in to do that and other things, too. I also heard, Randy...
That could be.
I also heard, Randy, that they're coming in because there is, you might say, manipulation to create a huge, on the floor of the ocean off of L.A., a huge man-made earthquake that could... do some damage, let's put it that way. And we've always been told that the great time that we're in, that the backup from the galactics to mitigate stuff like they're trying to do. And that would make sense because their biggest trump card here is to cause the complete collapse of all of the banking operations in L.A. and say, sorry, that's what caused it. It was a natural disaster. We didn't do anything wrong, routine. So that being said, the Russian operation is doing the same thing underground bases in Syria with Andromedan technology, off-planet help from the Andromedans. So, and again, we didn't say this, but on Ashtar, let me just tell this part right now, because on Ashtar on the road, Rama had just on Tuesday spoken with Natasha.
Yeah.
And she pulled out her amino acid galactic iPad, and the waiter, I said waiter, it was the waitress, but she was looking too. She was a millennial, wasn't she?
Yeah.
And I mean, they were all, this is an organic, a beautiful organic restaurant here in Santa Fe. And, just to say that the energy is really good. In other words, there's no problem with being able to work with that energy. If you're not doing it, I'm doing it.
Oh.
We got to do that now.
Oh, I see.
Okay, and then you put it back on when it comes back. Live on screen... Natasha was showing the two of them and herself. She was watching on screen portals upon portals upon portals opening up inside the sun, and fleets upon fleets upon fleets of Wingmaker craft coming into our orbits here around the Earth. And these craft are each the size of 6 city square blocks. And she said this has been going on for days and days, and it's going to continue. In other words, it's nonstop. And remember, the Wingmakers are from 175 million years into the future. And what is their mission? To make sure that what already happened, because all time present. So when they made their bilocation from that far into the future, they came here to make sure that at this point in time, the wake-up call and the possibilities of overcoming something that in the future didn't need to be, which was one-third of the Milky Way galaxy being missing by the same, you know, power that's, you know, not human. These are invaders, galactic, intergalactic invaders and occupiers of this planet, vying for this place's control. And the reason that this has been such a wanted purchase, if you want to say, Sarah, enslavement, is because the possibility of their accountability, meaning really all of us as a human race, and every damage that has ever been incurred in this, you might say, interruption of a divine plan so that we can get back on track. And that goes all the way back to ancient Mu.
Yeah.
And everything that's ever happened in every timeline. Because, again, what happens is that when they are going to be sent to the Dark Rift, and many of them have already done that, and all we're seeing is a ghost, a hologram or whatever's up there, for most of them. But the time-space continuum of every incarnation is erased, past, present, and future, including that one-third of the Milky Way galaxy being gone. It's all erased, and that's what brings us back onto the timeline. So that's also why these energies, which have been building since harmonic convergence from the age of the sixth sun, entering our time-space continuum now. I mean, it's just that enormous. And I guess you got to go fix America tonight that's not on up there. Mm-hmm. So anyway, what we're saying is that we are a very fortunate bunch. And just go up there and do it and come right back down and finish this drama. These craft are here and coming in continuously right now to help Mother Sekhmet with her ship, the Nibiru, to uplift Earth's vibrations to the 12th dimension. And it is happening exponentially very, very fast. And again, then she kind of brought up what, you know, some of the things that are true about the report from Benjamin Fulford. She made it very clear that the bushes are broke, like Rama was saying. And that means also their funders are broke, which are the Dutch royals. And the Dutch royals are the family of Donald Trump. So what Natasha said is Donald Trump doesn't even have $1 billion. He's broke. And so the crazy stuff out there is definitely getting crazier because these people are looking for what they can grab onto because they have fear. And so we need to send love. That's what's going on. The Rothschilds are in deep trouble as well. Many of their assets around the world are being bought out by the Chinese. Their gold and other precious metals are being bought out by the Chinese. And setting that aside, we got to remember Saint Germain has interuniversal, intergalactic gold, silver, platinum, and other precious metals, and all kinds of other things. Anyway, the amount is quattro decillions, 40 zeros and more for the debt jubilee. This is the seventh year, which is the debt jubilee, the 50th year. And Francis, who is not the Pope, but he has been decided to be exited by the Rothschilds. And again, these are desperate men in desperate times. So they have given him a tumor in the brain. It's considered benign. Yet the pressure in his brain, affecting his brain and his balance and his present time awareness, on Tuesday morning, he was climbing the stairs to the altar for Vespers very early in the morning, and he lost his balance and he fell full backwards. And two priests caught him, so that's okay. But I'm just saying that in the desperation now, they want to put a very, very not nice, I think they want to put something in there that can pass for a fake prophet, or they say in the apocalypse or whatever.
That story called Revelations.
Which Mother said a long time ago that is canceled. So.
Right.
Anyway, on another note, Mr. Netanyahu is in a very close moment to exiting stage left. And today, Catherine and Larry and Curly and Tom also told Rama that Mr. Netanyahu had come, and he was told this by Natasha, too. It just was repeated that when Netanyahu came on Monday, he wanted mullah, of course. And we just have to make sure you haven't missed this, but on the news, they keep saying that they're only $3 billion every year that's been going to Netanyahu, and it's always been $6 billion plus all kinds of extras when he says, oh, I need something for this and something for that and something for the other thing. And so now he wanted $5 billion more in addition to the $6 billion to, you know, plan his next shenanigans. And today, just today, there were two quote-unquote suicide bombs in the suburbs of Beirut. And that's not pretty. And it killed 37 so far, and there's hundreds of people very seriously injured. And then they, on our news, they're saying, oh, ISIL did it. And there's a message out there that from so-called ISIL. And that's not who did it. Israel Netanyahu did that. And see, these guys are out for every kind of blood they can take with them. They can't stop it. Then, in other words, he left penniless. Barack Obama was, and I just love this. I mean, on Monday night, I think it was Monday night, yeah, on Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell, Joy Reid was on there, and she just was, you know, asked what she thought about the event with Netanyahu and Barack, and she said, well, it was very chilly in that room, and if it got it any colder, everybody would swear they were in a deep freeze. And we're going to send them more love and thaw them out, everybody. But he did not get one thing from, and I know something they said, some millions or tens of millions they said he got, well, he didn't get anything. And that's chum change planting for what he wants. You know, I'm just saying it's all happening. And the point of all of these stories right now, as Natasha said to Rama, is that all of heaven is here. The next step is how we get introduced to our ancient and future past. Call on Sana Kumara. Call on Lady Master Venus. Lady Master Cassiopeia. Portia, Commander Saint Germain, Lord Katumi, and the Mahdi. And there is something about the Mahdi that we were talking about. What was that right before we came on, Rama?
About the Dalai Lama and his cat.
And
that very possibly, you know, he... He is one of the ones at the moment holding the energies of the 10th incarnation of Kalki Maitreya along with Sai Baba and Babaji. You know, they all hold...
And Krishna has never left the planet.
No.
There's no such thing. Even though they told the exact same story about Krishna as we have learned about Christ. And this is why there actually began in 1977 a comparative study between the teachings of the Buddha and the teachings of the Christ. They are identical teachings.
Yeah.
And the Buddha and the Christ are incarnations of the one we call Sananda Kumara. And there's been numerous incarnations like that. Krishna was another one. And, yes, Kalki Maitreya is known as the 10th incarnation of, you might say, the energy or the ray of cosmic Christ consciousness, with the emphasis on cosmic, meaning that we merge our enlightened consciousness in a unity, a universality of consciousness with all universes. And there are seven super universes in every time-space continuum there is. And that's the gate, 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 parasangate, bodhisvaha. Beyond, beyond the beyond, beyond the beyond, the beyond. There I am. All that is. That's what it means to be enlightened. It means I am everything and nothing. And we finished this book called Buddha in Red Face. We finally completed it. And this is a good book.
It is.
It is talking about what we are all here doing. We're all here to end war. We're all here to end nuclear proliferation on this planet. And this is a story of a life of a enlightened being named Terence, who literally had taken on a student along the path. And this was a Westerner that was thinking he was just a psychologist and, oh my God, or a social worker.
Down the rabbit hole.
And he actually opened his heart and woken through the guidance, and there were others. And he was here before, and he was taken on journeys to remember that. And he actually went into the pit and dismantled something that, quote-unquote, shamans who got their ego in the way created, which was the nuclear energy and proliferation thereof in the past when he was a part of it. And he went into the pit underneath Los Alamos Labs, and he dismantled it with love.
Yeah.
And he was there with Quetzalcoatl and Tezcatlipoca and Lucifer, and I forgot who else. There was one more. Sananda.
Right.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And these are like ending polarity. This is what the story is about, and that is exactly what we're all about right now. So I'm going to read one more thing, and that's why this polarity, meaning this unconscionable extreme of non-reality, ceases to exist, because really and truly there isn't anything but oneness, oneness of beingness. So I'm going to just take a moment right now, and I'm going to read from this book, and it's called The Secret Teachings of All Ages by Manly Palmer Hall. And this is an encyclopedic outline of Masonic, Hermetic, Kabbalistic, and Rosicrucian symbolical philosophy. And in the very front page, there's a full picture of Prince Rakosi of Transylvania, Comte de Saint Germain, and that is really who he looked like.
Mm.
And
the wig he's got to get rid of.
Being an interpretation of the secret teachings concealed within the rituals, allegories, and mysteries of all ages by Manly Palmer Hall. Full page illustrations, la-di-da. And this was printed, published by the Philosophical Research Society, Inc., Los Angeles, California. And this is a jubilee book for our debt jubilee, Nasara Now, coming up. And this book is dedicated to the rational soul of the world. And this first page is preface to the Diamond Jubilee Edition. On occasion of the 16th anniversary of this volume, it seems fitting to reflect on the circumstances that led to its writing. Come right down as soon as you're done with that last change. The original edition was planned and issued in the interval between the termination of World War I and the Great Depression of 1929. During this time, I had a brief career on Wall Street, the outstanding event of which was witnessing a man depressed over investment losses take his life. My fleeting contact with high finance resulted in serious doubts concerning business as it was being conducted at that time. It was apparent that materialism was in complete control of the economic structure, the final objective of which was for the individual to become part of a system providing an economic security at the expense of the human soul, the human mind, and the human body. I felt strongly moved to explore the problems of humanity, its origin and destiny, and I spent a number of quiet hours in the New York Public Library tracing the confused course of civilization. With a very few exceptions, modern authorities downgraded all systems of idealistic philosophy and the deeper aspects of comparative religion. Translations of classical authors could differ greatly, yet in most cases the noblest thoughts were eliminated or denigrated. Those more sincere authors whose knowledge of ancient languages was profound were never included as required reading, and scholarship was based largely upon the acceptance of a sterile manifestation. Fortunately, since contemporary scholarship had little regard for the wisdom of the past, there was no premium on the earlier texts. As a result, I assembled a fair collection of works of those forgotten sages to whose labors the world owes a tremendous debt of gratitude. It seems that my efforts were timely, and the first two editions of the book were sold out before the volume came off the press. There was certainly a blessing upon this book. Written by a young man in his 20s, it has now passed through a number of editions with over 30 printings and is still a bestseller in its field. We are now coming to the end of the 20th century. This was 1997, but we're now where we are. And the great materialistic progress which we have venerated for so long is on the verge of bankruptcy. We can no longer believe that we are born into this world to accumulate wealth and abandon ourselves to mortal pleasures. We see the dangers and realize that we have been exploited for centuries. We were told that the 20th century was the most progressive that the world has ever known. Yet, unfortunately, the progression was in the direction of self-destruction. To avoid a future of war, crime, and bankruptcy, the individual must begin to plan his own destiny. And the best source of the necessary information comes down to us through the writings of the ancients. We have tried to select the most useful and practical elements, practical elements, the writings of the ancients. We have tried to select the most useful and practical elements of classical idealism, combining them into a single volume. The greatest knowledge of all time should be available to the 20th century, not only in the one shilling editions of time, of the Bohn Library, B-O-H-N Library, in small type and shabby binding, rather in a book that would be a monument, not merely a coffin. John Henry Nash, who designed this book, agreed with me. It is our sincere hope that this book will endure into the 21st century, it obviously has, and continue to make available the contents of countless books and manuscripts that have been destroyed by the ravages of war. This volume is not devoted to my own opinions, rather to a tribute to the memories and labors of the noblest of mankind. May the 21st century bring with it a restoration of those systems of inspired instruction so desperately needed. Manly Palmer Hall. And just to remind everybody, Manly Palmer Hall was the reincarnation in 1901 of Madame Blavatsky, who was killed by poisoning by our government in 1891. So the soul took a 10-year respite and came right back. And then Manly Palmer Hall was killed by our government. He was killed by using feathers to suffocate him, thrust it down his throat. And that happened in 1991, which is an interesting year because that is the year that George Bush Sr. was taken out by our King of Swords and three more of his good men after he signed a document granting the merit of the Pigford case, which is the farm claims, granting the merit of this case to be heard before the people, before a justice, a federal court, which didn't happen until 1993 in early January. This is why we are here. This is the reason that this is part of our mission, because we all incarnated, no matter from the highest to the lowest, to actualize what was written in this preface of this Diamond Jubilee edition. That was, I think that was done in 1988. That's when he wrote it, and then 3 years later, he was removed from the planet.
I don't know. We had a copy of it way back there, but I don't remember the date.
Oh, well, Rama's got the older one, you know.
Right.
He's got the one that was way back then. And this is beautiful. It's really beautiful. And they have it in paperback now. And this was given us on loan by Carl Callahan.
Well, the one I have, the original one I had was one that was like 18 inches tall and 12 inches wide or something. It was a huge thing.
Yeah, this is the same size. It's just that it's in paperback. You just got to treat it with care. It makes it a less expensive. I'll just say that. But all the plates, everything is in full same color. It's just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so it is. So we are all.
So we're at the end of the second or the first hour here. I don't know what you want to do. Did you want to play something? You want to just go ahead and talk? You know, it doesn't matter to me.
Well, I think we're gonna start because at the end of this, we want to finish the last 20 minutes of Dr. Greer. So we got to get started. So let's do that. And so Rama will change the furniture. The first piece we're going to play, Robert said, let's do Dr. Richard Wolff first. And it's on the big picture, so it's in sequels. And it's about 40 minutes. So we're going to get started. And he's really going to go across the whole financial craziness, including the TPP, and he's going to show us how this whole thing weaves together and how we're coming to the finish line and from another perspective. As he says, I am a communist.
I am a Marxist.
I am a Marxist without the horns. That's what he has always introduced
Karl
himself.
Marx is not a bad guy.
Well, I mean, he's a wonderful being. You'll see, and we'll get started now. I was going to change the furniture here. Just talk into that thing. You can't just talk on the back of it.
I'm not. It's coming along here.
All right. Then you're going to turn that when it's time. You got to turn that face. Okay. Oh. 1 second, everybody. Just tell him, wait. Just wait. Tell me.
Uno momento.
Okay. 24 hours. is the new number one selling.
We're in Washington, D.C., and tonight we talk to one man for the hour, economist and author Richard Wolff, in a special economics edition of The Big Picture. You need to know this. History is never simple or clear-cut, but when it comes to 20th century American history, there's a very, very obvious break right around 1980. Those in the political side of things explain the break as the moment right-wing conservatism finally broke through to the mainstream and ended the liberal consensus of the New Deal from the 30s through the 60s, or the 80s, really. But that's only half the story. The historical page turn that occurred right around 1980 wasn't just a break between liberalism and conservatism, although that was an important part of it. It was also a break between two very different ways of organizing the American economy. Before 1980, America was run more or less according to the ideals of Keynesian economics. After 1980, it was run according to the ideas of monetarism, fancy academic term for Reaganism or Reaganomics. Joining me now for the next hour to talk about this big break in American history is Dr. Richard Wolff, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, visiting professor at the New School, and author of books, including his most recent, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Dr. Wolff, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
It's always great to see you. I wanted to talk about what America was like under Keynesian economics, but first I wanted to ask you, if, as an economist, if you think that the way that I split that up, that American history and that setup between Keynesian economics and Reaganomics, is reasonable, a reasonable assessment, and if you could define the terms, the major characteristics of Keynesian economics and Reaganomics.
Sure. The first part is easy. Yes, you did a fine job. You get a good grade in an economics course taught by almost everybody.
Okay.
As to the two, basically, and the simplest way to get it is in Reaganomics or monetarism or neoclassical economics, the basic idea is that capitalism is a well-articulated system that is most of the time in very good shape, and that if and when it runs into problems, A, those are temporary, and B, the system will self-correct, and you won't have the problem lasting very long, and that the best cure is to let the system fix itself. Keynesian economics, which after all was born when the British economist John Maynard Keynes was living through the Great Depression of the 1930s, the kind of economics that made sense to him was to look around, as he asked us to do in his great work, and see that the system wasn't working. You had millions and millions of people unemployed. You had huge portions of the productive apparatus of the society sitting idle, not being used. Clearly something was fundamentally wrong. And he basically concluded that if you leave a capitalist system to its own devices, you will get instability, periodic downturns that from time to time will be catastrophic recessions and depressions, and that that involves suffering that is unnecessary, loss of product, which is unnecessary, huge unemployment and social problems, and that it's much better to have the government come in and interfere in the economy in a variety of ways to get the benefits of capitalism without paying the horrific costs that the Great Depression made so clear. So what has happened is, ever since then, a debate between those who want the government out of the picture, let the system function on its own, versus those who say that's way too dangerous, that's way too inefficient, the government has to play a major role, or else not only will we have unnecessary suffering, but in the end, the mass of people won't tolerate the continuation of a capitalist system that produces this instability, this inefficiency, and this inequality.
So let's talk about what America was like under Keynesian economics first, because it was very different then. The main difference, at least to me, being the fact that the economy was way more equal back then. We've got a chart that demonstrates this, the historic top income tax rate and the income inequality in the United States. And you see that, you know, when Reagan came into office, first of all, top income tax rate collapsed, and secondly, inequality started to explode. But before we get into all of that, let's just, if you could just describe for people who were not alive
during the period of, you know, 1935 to 1981, what was America like? How did the American economy work?
Well, the basic reality was that the private economic sector, private enterprises hiring workers to produce things, was puffing along at something like two-thirds of what the country needed. That is, we had a huge percentage of our people unemployed. In the 1930s, upwards of 25% of our workforce was unemployed. We had vast sectors of the economy that were not only not producing growing amounts of output, they were producing less year after year than the year before. We had an economy that simply wasn't working. And so the solution, again, coming out of Keynes's way of thinking, the solution was for the government to come in and do all kinds of things. Let me just give a few examples. The government stepped in during the 1930s and created for the first time a minimum wage, that the poorest workers had to be paid a good bit more than they had been being paid, so that you would build the economy up, if you like, from below, instead of trickle down, push up kind of economics. Number two, the federal government undertook a direct spending program hiring people. Millions and millions of Americans who could not find a job in the private sector because they weren't there got jobs in the public sector. And the interesting thing was that many of those jobs built up the transportation facilities, the schooling systems, the road systems to help the economy grow in ways that the private sector wasn't doing. So you had millions of people earning money, spending that money, creating demand and jobs, and you had the government improving the economy by taking care of what we nowadays call infrastructure. I could continue, but the point is made, you had active government involvement at every step of the economy. I'll give you one more example. Americans couldn't afford to buy homes because of the Great Depression. The government stepped in and created the Federal Housing Authority that later became Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and all the other institutions, whose basic job is to have the government guarantee the loans from banks to homeowners to enable them to buy a home. By doing that, and by the way, the government still does that in this country, you created the demand for housing that put millions of people to work building the housing, building the roads to and from the housing. When you look at the overall picture, it's massive government intervention, not in competition with the private sector, but to take care of all of the economic needs that the private sector was failing to meet. And people took that as a necessary step. They saw the private sector as full of problems and the government intervention as the solution.
How do we communicate that to people who were, children who were born in the 70s or 80s or after, who have no specific, you and I are old enough to remember what America was like before Reagan changed our economy. How do we communicate that to young people? How do you communicate that in your classes?
Well, I don't think, to be maybe a touch pessimistic, I don't think you can communicate that in a country like the United States, where you have such a blowback starting with Reagan. The Reagan election and everything that happened since was the culmination in the angry bitterness of the business community and the community larger than the business community, because they were unhappy with Keynesian economics. They were unhappy with the Great Depression. What I didn't mention before when I spoke about the government hiring program and so on was that the business community had to pay the taxes. The rich in America had to pay the taxes that allowed the government to build up the economy from below. They liked the buildup. They didn't like paying the taxes, so they went to work to portray the government, which was taxing them, as evil, as inefficient, as not the solution, but itself the problem. They've reversed the whole story. And we live in a culture that has grown up, at least since the mid-70s, as a society overwhelmed by the paid information from those who never liked the New Deal, trying to suggest that the government is the problem, the government is the problem. So I don't think that a few of us, however courageous you on your programs and I in my speeches can be, we're not going to win that struggle given the forces arrayed against us. What will enable us to win, and I think that's already happening, is that capitalism is proving again, like it did in the 1930s, that when you go through a period of pulling the government back, you get the very economic problems that brought Keynesian economics into existence in the first place. Great inequality, large numbers of people barely getting by, insufficient job quality, insufficient job quantity. As these problems percolate and spread through the society, that's what's going to make people begin to realize that left to its devices, this capitalist system leaves us so dissatisfied that we begin to need to look for alternatives. And Keynesian economics is at least one way to face the problem and begin to find a solution.
Yeah. In the 30 seconds we have left, what I say to younger people is when I was growing up, nobody had student debt. A person with a high school diploma could get a job, as my dad did, in a tool and die shop and raise a family and take a vacation every year and pay off his house before he died, and, before he retired, actually. Have a full retirement with a pension, even. And people are like, what's a pension? So is that I think that's a start. Anyhow, we'll continue this conversation more with economist All Richard right. Wolff right after the break. He graduated from high school, joined the Army, went off to World War II, came back from the Japanese occupation, and on the GI Bill, went to college for a couple of years. My mom got pregnant with me, so he had to drop out. But he got a job in a tool and die shop that was a unionized tool and die shop, and worked there for 40 years and raised four kids and the whole bit. It was just, it had, a full, this full life that was available to people before Reaganomics. And when we look at union membership, another thing that lines up almost exactly with income inequality and middle class prosperity is union membership. How did unions play into the Keynesian system?
Well, the importance of the union movement in this country, which really took off during the Great Depression, it's worth a word about that. Americans responded to the Great Depression from 1929 to 1940-41, basically, in a way that's quite different from how they have responded, at least so far, to the current crisis since 2008. What I mean is, in the 1930s, Americans decided that their best strategy to get through this terrible depression was to join a labor union, that they felt they would have a better shot at coming through this disaster less hurt than they otherwise might if they were part of a collective organization, a labor union, that could struggle for the benefits of all working people. It was a decision they made, which is why millions of them joined the CIO. It was the greatest organizing drive, union membership drive, that the United States has ever seen. We've never had anything like it before. We've never had anything like it since. And as these people joined the labor movement, they not only demanded better wages and working conditions, but they realized their own political power, that the unions, especially if they worked together, could not only change what kind of salary and wage and benefits you got, but by working together, they would begin to be able to shape the outcome of political struggles, whether it be in the city or the state or the federal government. And they're the ones who basically went to the President of the United States at the time, Franklin Roosevelt, and said to him, you have to do something for the mass of people. You cannot respond to this crisis by only taking care of the banks and big companies who brought us the crisis. You have to do something for the mass of people, something which I think the mass of people wanted in the last 5 years, too, but didn't really get. because we didn't get a public hiring program. We didn't get any of the things, the interventions of the sort that the Franklin Roosevelt regime did. And I think that's because unions are not only a way to push up the economy from below by getting better wages and working conditions, they're also the political force that can bring into being policies like Keynesian economics that get the government in there to make the kinds of conditions your father enjoyed.
Yeah. So to move on from Keynesian economics, let's look at post-1980 Reaganomics. As an economist, what do you think are the biggest changes that have been brought about in the American landscape since 1980 as a consequence of Reaganomics or trickle-down economics or supply-side economics or, you know, whatever they call it?
I think the period since the 1980s might best be described from an economics point of view as the revenge of all of those who never liked what the New Deal was, who never wanted the government to intervene, who didn't like that they had to pay taxes. If you look at the history of income inequality and wealth inequality in the United States, we were quite unequal going into that Great Depression, and we came out much less unequal, that the gap between rich and poor was starkly and sharply reduced during the Great Depression by the New Deal. And while that was wonderful for the mass of people, why it created the conditions that you described so well with your father, it was done at the expense of those at the top. And when they got Reagan back in there, it was part of their revenge, their undoing what the 30s to the 60s had achieved, and I believe its main purpose was also its main achievement. They made the super rich again. They relieved the corporations of their constraints, allowing them to make much more in the way of profits, taxing those profits much less than was done before. That hamstrings the government, so it doesn't have the revenue because of all these tax cuts, particularly on corporations and the rich, so it can't deliver the services it once did to the mass of people. That turns the mass of people off, and so they become bitter about this, and they become people who are willing to listen to the attack on the government, who are able to say it's the fault of the government and thereby hide the fact that they've been working overtime for 40 years to cripple the government, to take away its resources. And so in the end, they achieved politically and economically the undoing of the New Deal. And its capstone was in the 1990s. When the single piece of legislation passed to control banks in the 1930s, the Banking Act of 1933, which limited what banks could do, was finally repealed by the Congress, and the repeal was signed by Bill Clinton as president. And literally, within a handful of years after you do that, the next financial crash comes, the capitalist system crumples down, mass unemployment returns. It's as if we're redoing the history of the last 50 years, only now without the excuse of not having gone through it before.
Yeah, you know, Arnold Toynbee, perhaps apocryphally, said when the last man who remembers the horrors of the last Great War dies, the next Great War becomes inevitable. Do you think if Phil Gramm had gone on the floor of the Senate in 1979 rather than 1999, when there were still people alive in the Senate who remembered 1929 and the Great Crash and the Great Depression, and suggested blowing up Glass-Steagall, saying, hey, you know, it's kept everything fine for the last 60 years, we don't need it anymore, that he would have gotten away with it? Wouldn't he have been laughed off the floor of the Senate?
He was. I mean, let's remember that in not that long before that, one of the most conservative presidents we ever had, Richard Nixon, went on the television and in front of the entire American people, when questioned about the government spending that he was undertaking, commented, famous line, "We are all Keynesians now." So at that period of time, whether you were a Republican or a Democrat,
you wouldn't have dared take away the government intervention. You are talking to a generation, for example, that had gone to college only because there was a GI Bill, because the government paid the cost of going to school. It transformed the American people into a much more educated population than we had ever been before. It transformed millions of lives. It created whole new industries. But in the end, it was a program initiated and paid for by the government. And that was the conception that all political perspectives shared, which is why the right wing and the big businesses had their work cut out for them between 1945, say, and 1975, to reverse all of that, to build up the network of think tanks and media outlets that would shake the country out of what it had learned from Keynesian economics and the Great Depression, to undo all of that, and therefore, unfortunately, as we now know, prepare the way for us to do the same to ourselves again.
All right, Brian. Just for some historical perspective, to what degree was Reaganomics something new on the world stage? And to what extent was it just a reversion back to Hardingism? Warren Harding in 1920 ran on the platform of dropping the top tax rate from 90% down to 25%, which he did. And his slogan was, less government in business, more business in government. In other words, deregulate and privatize. Isn't that Reaganomics? That was 1921.
Absolutely. This is the same battle. It is not new. It is old. It makes you even wonder, since we've gone through it more than a few times, how we are able once again, with a peculiar kind of historical amnesia, to be required to go through this again. I mean, give you another example, not to change the topic, but Germany is imposing on Greece an absurd depression, as if it did not know what in the past has destroyed, literally destroyed the European economy, created two world wars in less than half a century in that sad part of the world. It's as if the lessons were not learned and we're going to have to go through it again. It seems to me that we are confronted with an economic system that doesn't work and that systematically undoes the temporary fix-it, which is all Keynesian economics ever was. It undoes even that when it has a chance, and thereby confronts everyone with this again. If ever I saw an argument that we ought to question this system and go on to something better, this is it.
Yeah, is rollback Reaganism or rollback Reaganomics a reasonable slogan, or should we use another one?
I think we have to get beyond it. If all we do is roll back Reaganomics, then we'll reinstitute, more or less of the Keynesian system. And whatever you think about the Keynesian system, it proved unable even to sustain itself. You have to ask the question, why wasn't it possible to dig the roots for Keynesianism deep enough so that it would survive? And I think the answer is that you don't deal with the fundamental enemies of the kind of society we want if all you do is have the government intervene, but you still leave all the basic power and decision-making in the hands of private corporations who draw ever more profits into the hands of their boards of directors. It's naive not to understand that they will use the profits and the positions they have to undo the very Keynesianism that irritates them. Unless we deal with that, even when we get Keynesianism, we can't keep it.
So that's, we just have 30 seconds. That's a variation on time to blow up Citizens United? Is that what you're talking about? Take money out of politics?
No, I think it's time to take money out of politics, but as long as you have unequal distributions of wealth and income, whatever you do, whatever laws you pass, the people with the money will get around them to keep that money from being taken by a political change. I think we have to bite the proverbial bullet and realize you got to change the system in terms of how it works at the base in the enterprises, or else you haven't dealt with the conditions that keep repeating this sad story
story of conventional economics, Keynesian economics, etc.
Right. Well, let's get to that right after this break. More with economist Richard Wolff right after this break.
That the years since Reagan, since 1980 more or less, are years of the revenge of those who never wanted the higher taxes on corporations and the rich, who never wanted the lessening of inequality that the 1930s and 40s and 50s represented. Well, then we have to acknowledge that it worked, that their policies, the Reaganomics, that happened and everything that followed, did the job. We went back to a society at least as unequal as it was leading up to the Great Depression. And the goal, if it was indeed to make the rich richer and everybody else poorer, has in fact worked. But here are then the consequences. Number one, the richer the people are who sit at the top, the more of the wealth of our society is in a sense neutralized up there. These people who have all of the wealth concentrated in their hands, the way your graphs showed so clearly and dramatically, they are the ones who now decide what to do with it. If they were to decide to invest all of that money and build up capacity and hire people for jobs, we might all not be having this conversation. But they don't. And the reason they don't is simple. The way they got rich was by everybody else being deprived of all kinds of opportunities, being deprived of the extra income with which they could have made more purchases. So the irony is, as you make the rich richer, you diminish the incentive for them to invest that money because of the very inequality that you've created. It's as if you have created a monster like Frankenstein who then ends up undoing even the conditions of his own wealth. And that's the situation we have. Way too much wealth, and for the mass of people, a drying up of good jobs, a drying up of jobs with benefits, a drying up of all the economic activity that we did have when we didn't have this inequality, causing us to have this imbalance in the way our economy works.
Let's turn to worker productivity. I think this is one of the most shocking of our graphs. Before Reagan, wages more or less aligned directly with productivity. As workers made more stuff and made more profits for their employers, they shared in that by having their wages go up. After Reagan, they flatlined, even as productivity rose tremendously. How did that happen?
Well, I believe this is the most important graph, the most important relationship of this whole story, because it explains so much. The green line on your graph, the graph of people's wages, flattens out after the mid-1970s. That's why the following fact is the truth, that if you adjust the money wages Americans get on average, then what they, in terms of what they can afford to buy with it, then the wage we get in terms of what it can buy is lower today as an average than it was in 1975. That's an amazing statement. We haven't gotten a bigger cut of the pie for 40 years. Meanwhile, the productivity of the American worker, how much he or she produced for your employer per hour, keeps going up. That's the red line. That's the rising productivity line. Productivity measures what the worker gives the employer. Wages or income refers to what the employer gives the worker. If what the employer gives the worker flattens out, while what the worker gives the employer goes up, it doesn't take rocket science to understand that the gap between the few who get their hands on the rising productivity and the many whose wages don't go anywhere will produce growing inequality. And indeed, what Americans did, because they didn't want to face this situation, they didn't want to admit to themselves what's happening. What Americans did, the working class, was to make up the difference between their wages not going up and the fact that they were supposed to give their children and themselves the American dream, by borrowing the difference, by creating a generation of people in debt over what they could sustain, which is why in 2008, the whole house of cards of debt and of this story of wages and productivity crashed around our ears. That hasn't been changed, by the way, since 2008.
productivity continues to rise regularly, and wages are as flat as a pancake, which means that the conditions that brought us the crisis of 2008, the global capitalist collapse, have in fact maintained themselves, threatening us at any time with another resumption of a downturn. And at that point, given the conditions that already exist in North America, Western Europe, and Japan, I'm afraid of anticipating where that could go.
You know, Professor Wolf, I get these conservatives on my program, basically spokespeople for the billionaire class, who constantly say, American business is taxed more than anybody in the world, and, all they need is a fainting couch. And yet, when we look at corporate profits, and we've got a graph for this, corporate profits have soared since the 1980s, with that little hiccup in 2008. They're just exploding. Is this also a symptom of the revenge of the rich, basically?
Absolutely. The profits of corporations have benefited from those flat wages. The productivity goes up, they get more and more from us as workers, and they pay us no more. I mean, this is nirvana for the business employer. This is a better situation than they imagined in their wildest dreams they would have, let alone lasting for a long time. When you have conservatives who talk in this way, which is patently false, I mean, if you know of any studies about comparing, for example, the rate of corporate taxation in the United States with that in many other advanced countries, you'll know that while some are a little lower and some are a little higher, we are in no way an outlier. We do not tax our corporations more than other countries do. It's just not true. But we live in a society that has for 30 years spewed out this revenge-filled notion of the badness of the government, the poor corporation and the rich as the victims, so that people can say almost anything, and until recently, without much fear of someone coming up and saying, hey, stop, you're making it up kind of as you go. Let me give you one example. The argument of the rich and the corporations throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s was, we're taxed too much. You must give us more profitability, lower our taxes, allow us to make more money, and then we will have a more healthy economy. Well, we cut the taxes the way they wanted. We flattened the wages the way they wanted. Do we have an economy that's in better shape? No. The rate of growth now of the American economy is way slower than what it was in the Keynesian days of the 50s and the 60s. Of course, there are many reasons for that. But the basic argument that they made, that if you just give them lower taxes and bigger profits, well, then our economy would boom, that isn't true. When we finally got rid of most of the restrictions on them and the regulations, we had the second worst collapse of capitalism in its history, the 2008 downturn, second only to the Great Depression of the 1930s. So the arguments that they're making are repeated all the time, but they're not true, and the reality of our situation shows that. The Japanese have just returned to another recession. They've already had two or three in the last 10 or 20 years. The unemployment rate in Europe is 12-15%. The unemployment in this country is said to be 5 or 6%, but that doesn't really work because that doesn't take into account the 5 or 6 million people who have left the labor force because they can't find work. If you count them as we should, then our unemployment rate is off the chart too. So in fact, we don't have anything to suggest that letting the capitalist system go on its own is a recipe for anything other than the very experience of the last few years.
Yeah, and yet that's what Herbert Hoover did for 3 years, and that's the Republican prescription. How does this level of inequality that we've been talking about and demonstrating with these charts and graphs, how does this level of inequality affect young people who are coming up now?
Well, it has a number of effects. For a few of them, and I'm grateful it's only a few, they make the decision. There's two options. You can either be in the super rich or you can't, and they've decided they prefer the first one over the second one, and so they kind of buy into the system, work very hard, and hope one day they will be part of the super rich, and often it takes many years before they realize that's not going to happen. For the majority of people, it is a kind of a shock. It's a kind of a process of coming slowly to terms with the fact that the promises made to them as they were growing up simply don't work anymore. You go to work and you will rise and be recognized. That doesn't happen. You go to school and get your degrees and study hard and you get a good degree and then you'll get a good job. That doesn't happen anymore either. People are becoming baristas making your coffee or driving your car around. They are hoping to get a job that isn't too awful. I think that we're still, as a nation, in a state of shock. We can't quite believe it, and when we finally come to terms with it, we try to convince ourselves it won't last very long. And with each year that it lasts, that's being eaten away. I think the huge crowds that are coming out for someone like Bernie Sanders prove my point. It took people a long time before they understood after 2008 that we were now in a bad place as an economic system because of something we had been doing, as you put it, for 30 or 40 years of Reaganomics, and that we're going to have to really change the system. And that's a scary thought, but as it settles into the brains of more and more people, they find what's coming out of the mouth of someone like Bernie Sanders much more interesting than anyone foresaw it would be. For me, that's one of the consequences of the kinds of inequality that now shape and shake this culture.
So let's talk about solutions right after this break. Have more with economist Richard Wolff right after this.
Get from that point.
Move the American to that at any. Welcome back. In the last segment, we looked at how Reaganomics has caused the unprecedented inequality we see in America today. So we've seen how Reaganomics crippled the middle class, made our economy dysfunctional. And now we're going to look at how we can roll back the damage of Reaganomics and reboot the American dream. Back with us is economist and author Richard Wolff and Professor Richard Wolff. Richard, what would the immediate effect of rolling back the Reagan tax cuts and just, you know, taking this piece by piece, just restoring our tax code to where it was between 1935 and 1980?
Well, one of the first things that would happen if we actually did that is that all the noise about the government's deficit would quickly disappear, because if we taxed corporations anywhere like what we did in the 1940s and 50s, and likewise if we taxed the rich like what we did in the 40s and 50s, the revenue coming into the government would be enormous. They wouldn't have to borrow anymore. There wouldn't be a talk of a deficit. They'd probably take in more money than they need, and they could actually pay down a portion of the national debt, or they could use the money coming in to do all the things that ought to have been done for years, such as relieve this generation of college students of the absurd debts that's driving many of them to abort their educations, to cut them short, to major in topics they don't love, will not be good at because they can't afford, it takes an extra year, all these kinds of things that are socially destructive. It would allow us to rebuild the cities whose neglect has led to things like the bankruptcy of Detroit or the catastrophe of places like Cleveland or Camden, New Jersey, or the dozens of other cities that are more or less in these kinds of situations, or it would allow the United States government to become a real partner in the rest of the world to overcome poverty so that we don't have to fight wars, because the arrival of Americans is a time of celebration and appreciation and not a time of fear. The things we could do if we tax corporations and the rich boggle the mind and represent a new direction for America as a society that a proper debate over a presidential election should be in full swing now about that, rather than having every candidate keep as far and clear away from that, again, excepting Mr. Sanders, as we now see them do. So that would be a step that would be radical and transformative in what it would make possible.
Yeah. Before Reagan, we sent a man to the moon, we cured polio, we cured smallpox, we changed the world for the better in many ways. We put, you know, millions of people to college. About 20 minutes ago in our conversation or thereabouts, you made the observation that Keynesian economics was not strong enough. I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember the exact phrase you used, but that its roots weren't deep enough, and thus the billionaire class was able to come along and basically rip it up with Reaganomics. What do you recommend that we do as an alternative to Keynesian economics and an alternative to Reaganomics? What should our policy discussion economically be about right now?
In my humble opinion, it has to go much further than what the government could or should do. We can debate all the time we want. We can even have good programs like this one where we explore these topics. But the bottom line is that the folks who sit on the top of this pyramid system, the leading directors of the major corporations in the United States, have every incentive to keep the system pretty much the way it is, and they have the resources to realize those incentives. If we want an economic system that doesn't serve them, then we have really no choice but to make it no longer the case that they have the resources to realize their incentives. They can want what they want. They can argue for what they want. That's fine. That's what an open society should have. But we have an unfair fight because those folks have the resources to realize what they believe, and those of us on the other side simply don't. Another way of saying this, the reason Keynesian economics didn't survive was that that group of people, the corporate leaders, the wealthy of America, had the resources to undo all of that. And if we leave them with the resources now, even if we went back to the tax structure of the 1940s and 50s, even if we reinstituted a version of Glass-Steagall or any of the other measures that have been suggested, they have the resources to undo what our struggles would achieve. That's what we learned in the last 50 years. So my conclusion is not that there's nothing we can do, not at all. My conclusion is learn from what we did wrong and do it right. You cannot leave some people in a control of a disproportionate amount of the wealth of society and then be surprised if they use that wealth to keep themselves at the top.
Sorry.
If we don't want that, then let's not fight over redistributing the wealth. Let's not distribute it unequally in the first place. We shouldn't have some people earning millions and millions of dollars and other people fighting to get $15 an hour as a minimum wage. That creates inequality. It creates the corruption of politics to keep that inequality in place. And that's what we have to go after. We have to democratize the question of who gets paid what portion of the work, the goods and services that we all together as a society produce. If we can equalize that, not everybody gets the same amount, but to make it a reasonable range, we will remove the very causes of most of the economic troubles and oppressions that we've been talking about.
And yet, as Bernie Sanders points out over and over again, two families, the Waltons and the Kochs, own more wealth than the bottom 40-45% of all Americans. Are you calling for a new Bolshevik revolution or something? I mean, how do you take that out of their hands without having the whole thing turn really, really ugly?
Well, I think my hope is that there's a movement going on in the United States already that I see growing, and that I have placed my hope in. And it's the movement for worker cooperatives. The idea that we ought to organize our industry, our factories, our stores, our offices, as a democratic workplace. That is, everybody in there together, democratically, one person, one vote, decides what the company will produce, how it will do the production, where it will do the production, and what is done with the fruits of everybody's labor. I am convinced, and this is a faith in the American people, that if we democratize our workplace, which Lord knows we should have done at the beginning of our history, not so late in the story, but if we democratize the workplace in the way I've just described, the people will together never give one person $1 million while everybody else has to forego college for their children. It's not going to happen. We would distribute the wealth in a completely different way, precisely because we don't want the conflicts, the unfairness, the injustice, the cruelty of having extraordinary wealth in a sea of middle class weeping and suffering and insufficiency. And I think if we get a movement going for worker co-ops as an alternative, if the American people can see how they work, can understand how they come up with different results, you'll see a vast change of consciousness and of political support for that kind of an institution, which I think points the direction for a solution, because the alternatives don't point to any solution, and that's not acceptable, not just to folks like me, but to the American people as a whole.
Well, back in the 30s, Franklin Roosevelt, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but my understanding of the era, you know, from what I've read and talking to people, my dad, for example, used to tell me stories of that time. Basically, FDR was walking this middle ground between literally fascists on the one hand. You had, you know, the Charles Lindbergh and others who were saying, oh, yeah, you know, what the Germans are doing, the Italians, we should emulate that. And communists on the other hand, saying, you know, look at the Bolshevik Revolution. We should be doing, you know, what Joe Stalin is doing. And because the fruits of both fascism and communism had not yet become evident. And so Roosevelt kind of saved capitalism from itself. If that premise is correct, what should Roosevelt have done, or what should we be doing, and how do we do that to bring about an economy that's not capitalist-based, that doesn't require an investor class, but that is rather, as you describe, you know, worker-based, worker co-ops. It's owned, you know, the economy is owned by the people who are producing things in the economy.
Well, first of all, I think your father was spot on. I think that the historical record and the economic research that's been done over the last 50 years bears him out, that Roosevelt did indeed save capitalism from the capitalists themselves. He went to the rich and the corporates, and he said, look, you better do what I'm suggesting, Keynesian economics, government interference, government support of the mass of people, because if you don't, you're going to have a revolution. It'll either produce Hitler or it'll produce Stalin or some amalgam of those two. And if you don't want that, let me at least try my middle ground. And he convinced enough of them to provide him with the political support to do exactly that. So that was his story. If you ask what was the mistake he made, the only mistake that I would identify is not understanding that by leaving the wealth of the country in the hands of private corporations, organized as they have been, with the major shareholders as the owners, selecting a board of directors, 10 or 15 people that make all the basic decisions. If you leave the control of the enterprises in those people's hands, then they will sooner or later have the incentive and the resources to undo whatever you've done. So that the mistake, if there was one, that we can learn from is don't do that again. This time, when you have a progressive tax structure, when you have limits on what banks can do with other people's money, and so on, you have to add to that the dispersion of corporate and productive wealth into the hands of the mass of people so that they can operate to make sure that what they have for themselves is not undone because they keep providing the incentives and the resources to the wealthy minorities that do it. That's why the worker co-op is the idea, the model, the direction to go into, because it institutionalizes a broad base of power. If I were to make a slogan around it, it would be this: if you want the economy to serve the people, the mass of people, then you have to put them in charge. You cannot have an economy serving everybody if it's controlled by a handful.
Brilliant. Professor Richard Wolf, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom, and thank you for having a program like this.
Thank you. And that's The Big Picture tonight. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, yours.
Okay, everybody. Now, the next one we're going to do, and we're just going to go right ahead, if that's okay
that's
with Marita.
Yeah.
Yes.
I just didn't know whether we needed to tell them to get ready, get the music ready.
Right. I'm sorry if I wasn't paying attention to that. I'm sorry. But it's 50 minutes instead of 40 minutes, so we should get going. But the next person is, and I just want to say Dr. Richard Wolf is getting ready to open a national bank, I mean a state bank, like the one in North Dakota. Here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. So he knows all about Nassara, and he's doing something to help everybody get their frame of mind to how the people can actually engage in making something worthwhile happen. And so I just wanted everybody to know that. And this next gentleman is an amazing person too. And, you know, we know about Dr. Keshe, yet, what I can say about Dr. Michael Mann is that he is talking about everything but what Dr. Keshe has to offer, but he's still doing that too because he's letting us know because we still have to do this. You know, that's the idea because the divine plan to work out is for light, love, and power to fill the earth, and that's our job, and that's why we ask that this divine Leela to be ours, and don't bug us. Let's do our free will choice, okay? Well, now's the time. And again, we don't have a pile of wingmaker ships coming in for days on end through the sun because this isn't the time. So here we go, everybody. This is another beautiful brother came in to help us do the right thing. And this is about our climate change.
In D.C., and tonight we talk to one man for the hour, climate scientist Michael Mann, in a special climate change edition of The Big Picture.
Just a second here.
This 100% of all credible climate scientists agree that global warming is real and that it's man-made. Some even think it's going to be a lot more destructive than we originally thought. So why is it taking so long to put together a comprehensive plan to stop climate change? For the next hour, we're going to delve into the details of global warming with world-renowned climate scientist Dr. Michael Mann. We'll go over the basics of what global warming is, what's causing it. We'll talk about some of the worst-case scenarios involving runaway climate change, take down the denial myths pumped out by the fossil fuel industry, and put forward solutions to the greatest environmental crisis our planet has seen, perhaps in the history of the human race. Joining me now from State College, Pennsylvania, is Dr. Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Meteorology and Director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, and the author of the book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Dr. Michael Mann, welcome back. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be with you.
Let's start off with the basics. Global warming is something most people have heard about, but probably even fewer actually understand. So can you walk us through it in layman's language? What is global warming? Why is it happening? And perhaps most importantly, how do we know that it's happening?
Sure. So, you know, despite the fact that climate change, global warming is sometimes characterized as new and controversial science, it's actually basic physics and chemistry that goes back nearly two centuries. And it has to do with the simple fact that certain gases in our atmosphere, like carbon dioxide, have this heat-trapping ability. They keep some of the heat that comes in from the sun, warms the planet. Some of the heat produced by the planet in response is trapped within the atmosphere, and so it warms up the planet to a higher temperature than it otherwise would be. In fact, if it were not for the greenhouse effect, we would live, or in fact, we probably wouldn't be alive. Earth would be a frozen planet. So the greenhouse effect, in fact, is responsible for the fact that the Earth is a habitable planet. Of course, too much of a good thing can be a bad thing. And in the case of fossil fuel burning and other human activities, we are increasing the temperature of the Earth's surface by raising the greenhouse effect to an extent that we are already seeing some very damaging impacts.
One of the biggest mistakes that people make when it comes to global warming or climate change is confusing weather with climate. Senator Jim Inhofe gave us a great example of it earlier this year. Check this out.
In case we have forgotten, because we keep hearing that 2014 has been the warmest year on record, I asked the chair, you know what this is? It's a snowball. And that's just from outside here. So it's very, very cold out, very unseasonal. So here, Mr. President, catch this.
So, Dr. Mann, a lot of people are persuaded by that kind of stuff. It got heavy coverage on Fox so-called news. So walk us through this. What's the difference between climate and weather? And why could we have such a cold winter when the planet is warming so rapidly, at least a winter in the East Coast here?
Right. So James Inhofe would do well to read some Mark Twain, because Mark Twain explained this more than a century ago when he said that climate is what you expect, weather is what you get. Climate is the statistics of the weather. We can't predict what the exact weather will be here in State College 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now, let alone several years from now. But we can predict that 6 months from now, it'll be colder. In a year from now, it'll then be warmer again. That's seasonality. That's the seasonal cycle, and that's climate. But climate is more than just the seasonal changes in temperature and rainfall patterns. It's the longer-term changes due to things like El Nino events, due to natural factors like volcanoes and small but measurable changes in solar output, and, of course, due to human impacts, due to the increase in the concentration of these greenhouse gases from fossil fuel burning and other human activities. So what we know is that heat waves are becoming more common and will become more common, and they'll become more intense. Hurricanes will become stronger. Sea level will continue to rise. We will see longer and more intense droughts over large parts of North America and other continents, and so on. Those are changes in the average statistics of the weather, and we know how they can change with some degree of confidence.
You're the creator of the now, famous... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, so it is true that we are seeing extreme weather events that we think are being impacted by climate change. And sometimes the connection is a bit non-intuitive. For example, the very cold winters we've had in some parts of the eastern U.S. in recent years are part of an unusual change in the track of the jet stream. And that same track of the jet stream that's been bringing some unusually cold air plunging southward into the eastern U.S. has instead been bringing all of the storms and the moisture with them up into Alaska, away from California. And that's part of why we are seeing record drought in California right now. So there are changes, for example, in the pattern of the jet stream that are giving us more extreme weather events of various sorts that we also think are related to climate change. We think that that change in the jet stream may be a result of the melting of sea ice up in the Arctic, which actually changes the heating of the atmosphere. It changes the pattern of the jet stream. So there are various ways in which extreme weather events that are becoming more frequent are probably as well tied to human-caused climate change.
You're the creator of the famous hockey stick graph. What does that graph tell us about global warming and climate change?
Well, it sort of reinforces what we already know. We know that the warming of the Earth is unusual, the warming that we've seen in recent decades over the last century. And we know it's because of increasing greenhouse gas concentrations from human activity, from fossil fuel burning. What we didn't know for a long time was just how unusual is that sort of warming in a longer-term context, because we only have about a century or so of widespread thermometer measurements around the globe. So from the instrumental data alone, we can only document how temperatures over the globe or temperatures in the northern hemisphere have changed over the past century or so. And that doesn't tell us, you know, how common it might be to see a warming trend of the magnitude we've seen over centennial timescales, farther back into the past. And so what we did back in the late 1990s was use information from what we call proxy records. These are indirect thermometers. They are things like tree rings and corals and ice cores and sediments, various physical or chemical measurements from our environment that actually tell us something about past climate conditions. And we used those data to reconstruct how the temperature of the northern hemisphere had changed over the past 1,000 years. And what we found was indeed that the recent warming has no precedent as far back as we were able to go. Now, since then, many other researchers using different methods, different types of data, have independently sought to reconstruct climate back in time. And we now know that the recent warming, the warming of the past few decades, is without precedent even farther back, at least 1,300 years, perhaps tens of thousands of years. Some of the work that's been done over the past few years suggests, at least tentatively, that we are now at a level of warming and a rate of warming that we cannot see going back into the last ice age and beyond.
Wow. Outside of the pure data, what's the major evidence of global warming that we can see around us right now?
Well, you know, we can see that ice is disappearing around the world, and it's doing so at an alarming rate. Mount Kilimanjaro, this magnificent ice-capped mountain at the equator in eastern equatorial Africa, immortalized by Ernest Hemingway's Snows of Kilimanjaro. Well, those snows are disappearing before our eyes. We are seeing the loss of that ice cap, and we know it's been around for more than 10,000 years. We are seeing ice retreat around the globe, sea ice, land ice, mountain glaciers, and the ice sheets, the Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet. We are seeing rates of retreat of ice that have no precedent in tens of thousands of years. And that's really the cause for concern. It isn't just how warm we've made the planet, but the rate at which we are warming the planet and the rate at which ice is disappearing, at which climate zones are migrating, climate change is occurring at a rate that is faster than we have reason to believe we or other living things can adapt to. It's really that rate, that dramatic rate of warming and of change in our climate. When human civilization developed over a period of relative climate stability, and we depend on that climate stability. In fact, it's leveraged now by a population of more than 7 billion people. And so we are highly dependent on the stability of our environment to support that very large population. And we're changing things faster than nature has changed them in the past. That's the cause for concern.
How is global warming affecting or interacting with some of the major environmental crises we're seeing right now? California's drought. There are people suggesting that the whole Arab Spring phenomena was the consequence of drought killing off the wheat crops in the Middle East, that sort of thing, in the minute we have left in this block.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the concerns here is that climate is what national security experts call a threat multiplier. It takes existing tensions over land, over water, over food, and it exacerbates those tensions because it reduces access to food, land, and water. And so it's sort of a perfect storm of consequences coming together to create potentially major national security threats, especially in regions like the Middle East, which are already a tinderbox. It's like adding fuel to the flame, climate change.
Yeah, it's remarkable. More with Dr. Michael Mann.
Just a second, everybody.
Where did the myth come from?
Yeah, it's one of what we call the climate change denial zombies. It doesn't matter how many times that myth, that talking point is disproven, is discredited. It just keeps on coming back. And there's absolutely no truth to the statement whatsoever. Every legitimate measurement of the temperature of the Earth, whether from satellites, whether from surface observations, thermometers, tells us that the globe continues to warm at a rate of about a degree Celsius per century. It's continuing on that trajectory as we expect it to. 2014 was the warmest year on record. 2015 is shaping up to be an even warmer year. 2015 is so far the warmest first half year that we've ever seen. So global warming continues apace. The globe continues to warm. Ice continues to melt at an alarming level. But you continue to hear these specious claims that the globe isn't warming. In part, comes from work that was done more than a decade ago, which has now been entirely discredited. There was one group, two scientists who were actually climate change contrarians, and they had claimed for the longest time that their satellite data showed that the Earth wasn't warming. When other scientists were able to get a hold of that data, what they found was that those scientists had made what we call a sign error. What that means is where there was supposed to be a plus in their algorithm, there was a minus sign. They were literally taking a warming trend and turning it into a cooling trend. And that work has now, you know, been exposed as invalid. Other scientists have gone in and done it the right way, and the satellites show that the globe continues to warm at the rate that we know it's warming from other lines of evidence. Another example is what climate change contrarians will do. There's a sleight of hand in what they will often do. They'll start with a very warm year like 1998. 1998 was the warmest year on record at that point. It was boosted by a big El Nino event, the warmest year we had ever seen at that point. Now, of course, we've seen even warmer years. And what they'll do is they'll start their trend line with that very high 1998 value, and then what they'll do is draw a trend line to subsequent years. Well, of course, those subsequent years are cooler because you had just set a record in 1998. And so if you start playing those games, it's easy to distort what's actually happening through faulty statistics. And if you do it right, if you do it objectively, you stand back, you estimate the temperatures of the temperature trends correctly, what they show is that the globe continues to warm at the rate that the climate models tell us it ought to be warming as we continue to pump these greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So no matter how many times these talking points, these zombie climate change denier myths are struck down or discredited or refuted, they just keep coming back because there's a large audience for that sort of misinformation and disinformation, and often there isn't somebody there to correct the record when these specious claims are made.
Tragically. The traditional benchmark for acceptable levels of global warming has been 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Why that number, 2 degrees Celsius, and what happens after 2 degrees Celsius, and how close are we to reaching that benchmark?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. We often hold out that number 2 degrees Celsius, about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit relative to pre-industrial times, as that level of dangerous interference with the climate system. We've already warmed 1 degree Celsius. We've probably got at least another 0.5 degree Celsius in the pipeline just from the greenhouse gases we put into the atmosphere so far. So that gives us a very small a cushion, very little wiggle room. There's only about 0.5 degree Celsius left to play with before we exceed that 2 degree Celsius warming threshold. And if we continue with business as usual fossil fuel burning for another decade, then we will commit to passing that threshold. That's why it's so urgent to reduce our carbon emissions now. Now, there is in reality no one fixed number, 2 degrees Celsius. A lot of bad things we think happen if we warm the planet 2 degrees Celsius, but even worse things happen if we warm the planet 3 degrees Celsius, and so on. So rather than this being a cliff that we fall off at 2 degrees Celsius, it's much more like a steadily sloping downhill, and the further we go down that hill, the more we imperil ourselves. But if we miss that 2 degree Celsius exit, if we're unable to reduce our emissions rapidly enough to avoid that 2 degree Celsius warming limit, it doesn't mean we give up. What it means is we take that next exit ramp. We take the 2.2 degree Celsius warming exit ramp. The less warming, the less likely it is that we will see dangerous and potentially irreversible changes in our climate. But, you know, if you talk to people in Tuvalu, if you talk to people who inhabit low-lying island nations, you talk to people who live in Miami Beach, you talk to people who live in California, they'll tell you that dangerous climate change isn't some far-off thing that might happen in the future. It's happening now.
Former NASA scientist James Hansen is saying that 2 degrees, that 2 degree threshold is actually too high, that it allows for devastating multi-meter high sea level rises. What do you think, and if Dr. Hansen is correct, what kind of consequences does that have for this whole process of how we try to stop global warming?
Well, you know, we dismiss what James Hansen has to say at our peril. He's often been criticized for making pronouncements like that, but he has also shown a penchant for being remarkably prescient. Back in 1981, he published a groundbreaking paper that literally predicted how much warming we would see in the decades ahead with a remarkable degree of accuracy. Back in 1989, he spoke on the U.S. Senate floor for the first time. A climate scientist said, you know, human-caused climate change is here. We are seeing it. And he was right then. So he has this remarkable history of making prescient predictions about the future. And what he's saying now should not be dismissed. He is arguing for the possibility that we will see quite a bit more sea level rise, more melting from the ice sheets, the West Antarctic ice sheet, the Greenland ice sheet, than climate models currently predict, more rapid sea level rise over the next 50 years than the climate models predict. And in fact, if you look at the climate projections, if you look at the predictions we've made about sea level rise, the predictions we've made about Arctic sea ice and how fast it would decline, in many respects, the climate is changing faster and with greater magnitude than we predicted just, you know, years ago. And so it may very well be true that Hansen is right, and the climate models that we're using right now upon which to base policy are actually underestimating the rate at which we will see a rise in sea level and a whole array of other negative climate impacts. It really stresses the fact, you know, what we call the precautionary principle. We are tampering with the only planet we know of in the universe that supports life. There is no planet B. If we screw this one up, there's no recourse. And so we should be extremely cautious in tinkering with a system we don't understand perfectly, because the changes may end up being far worse than we predict today.
Some scientists, like Dr. Guy McPherson, have an even bleaker view of global warming, say that it's making such drastic changes to the atmosphere that it's pushing us outside the habitable zone, and that we might have already passed some irresistible or irreversible tipping points. Here's a quick clip of Guy McPherson on that.
We're so close to the sun, we're so close to the inner edge of the habitable zone for life on Earth, that even a minor change in atmospheric composition could push us out of the habitable zone. Well, we haven't made minor changes in the atmospheric chemistry of the Earth. We've made major changes in the atmospheric chemistry of the Earth.
So what do you think about that? Could global warming lead to the end of much or all life, or at least all large and complex life on Earth?
Well, I don't know about that. There's, you know, quite a bit of uncertainty about the projections, and we always have to keep in mind the worst-case scenarios because, as I said before, the climate model projections have a history of actually having been too conservative, and the scientific community, in a sense, has a history of having been too conservative. So we shouldn't dismiss out of hand voices like James Hansen or even McPherson, who are telling us that, you know, it could be worse than what the climate models are currently telling us. That having been said, based on my assessment of the science, my objective assessment of what the science actually tells us right now, I don't think we've passed a you know, a tipping point yet where, you know, we go beyond the adaptive capacity of human civilization or beyond the adaptive capacity of living things. I don't think we've yet crossed that line. We have certainly committed to some dangerous changes in climate already, and it's possible we have already warmed the oceans enough that they're going to melt the ice shelves around Antarctica enough to destabilize enough of that Antarctic ice to give us, you know, 10 feet or 11 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century. That is a very real possibility. And so there is some amount of adaptation that we are going to have to engage in. It isn't just a choice between mitigation, you know, reducing our carbon emissions, and adaptation, taking measures to deal with the changes that are coming. We're going to have to do both. But I think a sober look at what the science has to say, based, for example, on the most recently released report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change just a year or so ago. The best available science tells us it's not too late, but there is an urgency, unlike anything we've seen before. There is an urgency now to reduce our carbon emissions, or we will potentially cross into what can only be described as the danger zone.
How long before we might hit that danger zone? You wrote a piece for Scientific American suggesting 2036, as I recall.
Yeah, if we continue with business as usual, carbon burning of fossil fuels, with the growth of, you know, emissions in countries like China and India and South America, it's only a matter of a couple decades before we cross that 2 degrees Celsius warming. And, you know, the science tells us a lot of bad things will happen with 2 degrees Celsius warming of the planet, but even worse things will happen with 3 degrees Celsius warming, and far worse things with 5 degrees Celsius warming. And we are on track to exceed 5 degrees Celsius warming of the planet by the end of the century if we continue with business as usual. That's a larger change in global temperature than from the height of the last ice age when ice sheets covered New York to today. We are talking about a monumental change in climate on a time frame far shorter than anything that nature has ever produced before. And that's the real problem. We're talking about rates of change, magnitudes of change, and rates of change that have no precedent in the past and, you know, may indeed, as some have speculated, lead to the sixth great extinction event. We are on course to the sixth great extinction event if we don't change our way of doing things.
More with Michael Mann. There's actually more carbon apparently there under the surface of the Arctic than there is in the Earth's atmosphere. What happens if that carbon gets out, and how could that happen?
Yeah, so there was a study just last year that suggested that we could essentially double the warming from CO2 alone, from carbon dioxide alone, from the potential release of some of this methane that's trapped in permafrost. It's trapped in the coastal shelves of the Arctic Ocean. And, you know, we can't rule out that scenario. It's a reminder that there is uncertainty. There are uncertainties. There are potential surprises that loom, and they're not going to be pleasant surprises. There are potential aggravating factors like the potential destabilization and release of methane that could make the problem worse than we currently project with our climate models. And so it once again highlights the fact that in many respects, climate scientists have been overly conservative in the scenarios that we've envisioned and the changes that we've projected for the future. It could potentially be a whole lot worse. Now, there's a lot of uncertainty there, and there is a fierce debate within sort of the carbon cycle scientists over just how much of that methane is potentially releasable into the atmosphere with, you know, the warming projected over the next century. Some scientists say that only a fairly small part of that is mobile. It can be mobilized by global warming. But some scientists think that potentially a much larger amount of that methane could be released. To the extent that there's uncertainty, it could once again break not in our favor, but against us. And so it's once again reason for precaution, for not tampering any further or with a system that we don't understand perfectly. And that's what we're doing. Distinguished climate scientist Wally Broker of Columbia University once said, it's like we are poking an angry beast with sticks. That's a dangerous thing to do, and that's what we're doing.
This is the first time in this hour that we've mentioned methane. Can you just very quickly, for viewers who might not understand why we suddenly went from talking about carbon dioxide to methane, what's the difference between carbon dioxide and methane, and why should we be concerned about methane in the Arctic or anywhere else?
Methane, it turns out, is a more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. A single methane molecule absorbs more atmospheric heating than a single CO2 molecule. Now, there are other complications in comparing them because methane has a different lifetime in the atmosphere. CO2 stays around for a very long time. Methane tends to be absorbed by the climate system on the time frame of a decade or two decades. And because of that, it just doesn't stick around as much. And so when you're comparing the two problems, you have to look not just at how much warming you can get, but the time scale over which that warming is likely to happen. And it turns out that your metric of danger, what you think of and what you envision as dangerous climate change, is going to determine to some extent the relative risks of these two contributors. If you are worried that we are going to pass some sort of tipping point within the next decade or two decades where we trigger things like the dramatic acceleration of the melting of the ice sheets or the shutdown of the ocean circulation pattern that helps warm Europe, the conveyor belt ocean circulation, or a fundamental shift in the way that El Nino behaves that could have profound impacts for drought and rainfall patterns around the world. If you're worried about those sorts of dramatic changes that could be triggered by an abrupt short-term amount of warming, then methane, it turns out, is a real player. Methane really has the potential to aggravate the warming that we see over the next decade or two. Now, if you're worried about sort of the longer-term warming of the planet, the longer-term changes in climate, well, then it's really CO2, which is the main player. And so, to some extent, one's concern about CO2 versus methane is going to depend on the things that you're concerned about happening, what your tolerance is, what your metric is for defining dangerous changes in climate. One would be best served by avoiding increasing the concentrations of both of them because they carry different types of risk as far as climate responses are concerned. Now, methane is getting into the atmosphere in a number of different ways. Methane is produced by livestock and by agriculture. So there's a certain amount of human-produced methane from agricultural practices, from livestock raising. But it's also escaping into the atmosphere because of fracking, because of natural gas drilling, the use of so-called hydraulic fracturing to try to get at the methane, the natural gas that's contained in the bedrock below, where fluids are injected and they crack the bedrock and allow that methane to escape and potentially be recovered. But some of it actually escapes into the atmosphere. It's what we call fugitive methane. And so the process of natural gas extraction and fracking, and that's potentially introducing methane into the atmosphere. We don't know exactly how much. It could potentially offset the nominal gains from natural gas, which is a little less of an intensive from the greenhouse warming standpoint as burning coal. It doesn't produce quite as much CO2 for the amount of energy that's generated. So some people have said, well, so natural gas, if we switch to natural gas from coal, that can help lower our carbon emissions. But if a lot of that natural gas is actually escaping into the atmosphere and it contains, and that natural gas is mostly methane, which is a very potent greenhouse gas, it could actually be making the problem even worse. Then there is the natural gas or rather the methane that is certainly trapped within the climate system, frozen in what's known as clathrate crystalline structure along the continental shelves of the oceans, the methane that's trapped in the permafrost. If we warm the planet up enough, we could, as we were discussing earlier, potentially release a lot of that, mobilize a lot of that methane, and that, again, would add substantially to greenhouse warming. So it's a potentially important player, and we have to be thinking not just about CO2, but about other greenhouse gases that are being produced by human activity, like methane.
Moving on to climate denialism, how has this taken such a grip in America, and is it as prevalent in the rest of the world?
Well, you know, climate denialism, to some extent, has been manufactured. There is an ongoing, decades-old, industry-funded disinformation campaign to confuse the public about the science of climate change. So fossil fuel interests and their abettors, the Koch brothers, Koch Industries, other conservative interest groups have been spending tens of millions of dollars to pollute the larger public discourse over this issue by manufacturing controversy, by misrepresenting the science, by attacking the science and scientists in op-eds and in conservative media outlets that have distorted the science of climate change for their viewers, Fox News, the Wall Street Journal editorial pages, which is a fount of misinformation and disinformation when it comes to climate change. So that didn't just happen by accident. It happened because there was a well-laid-out, well-financed strategy detailed decades ago to generate a fake debate about climate change to prevent action from occurring, to prevent the regulation of carbon emissions, because those vested interests well knew that as long as they could maintain the appearance of controversy, the appearance that climate change is still debated by scientists, that would be enough to convince the public that we're not yet, we don't have the degree of certainty necessary to act on this problem. When ironically, if anything, the uncertainty is breaking in the other direction, things are potentially going to be even worse than what we have projected previously. So there has literally been this poisoning of the public discourse through tens of millions of dollars of special interest funding of front groups. They hire fake experts with impressive credentials to attack their fellow scientists, to attack the science. They have created front groups which manufacture misinformation, which produce talking heads that go on television news programs, that write op-eds and leading newspapers misleading the public about climate change. You see it here in the U.S. where there's a lot of fossil fuel money and there's a very large and powerful fossil fuel industry. You see it in Australia. You see it anywhere where there is a large vested interest that doesn't want to see the regulation of carbon emissions. You see you see these sorts of misinformation campaigns intended to distract the public and policymakers and lead them astray and prevent action from being taken.
Well, and meanwhile, we see that at least with television, for example, there's actually very little coverage of climate change. PBS beats CBS, ABC, and NBC by almost 2-1, or maybe more than 2-1, last year, and just even discussing the topics. Why do you think it is that Americans are so willing to accept that narrative of the climate deniers? Is it because there's so little coverage, or is it because people just, you know, want the rosy outlook?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a combination of factors. The fact is that many of these television news programs and many of the networks receive a lot of advertising money from fossil fuel interests. You can't watch, any of the cable news networks without seeing multiple advertisements from the American Petroleum Institute, from ExxonMobil, sort of a greenwash where they present themselves as caring about the environment at the same time that they spending tens of millions of dollars misinformation and perpetuating misinformation about climate change, at the same time that they're hiring front groups to attack the science of climate change, sort of speaking out of both sides of their mouth. And so I think to some extent it has to do with biting the hand that feeds you. Many of these networks probably don't want to upset these corporate sponsors. And so there hasn't been the sort of hard-hitting journalism, whether it's in the newspapers or whether it's, on television, that there ought to be, given the magnitude of the problem and the magnitude of the threat that it represents.
Right. More with Dr. Michael Mann right after this break.
Unfortunately, procrastinated in acting on this problem, and there's a great procrastination penalty. If we had acted on the problem decades ago, when we had enough information already to know that climate change was real, it was caused by human activity, and it was going to increasingly be a threat, if we had acted then we would have been able to undergo a fairly slow and methodical transition away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy, to other forms of energy. We could have undergone a slow enough transition that it could be accomplished fairly inexpensively. If you think of the carbon emissions, if we had brought them to a peak decades ago and had then gently brought them down in such a way as to avoid dangerous warming of the climate, the emissions curve would have looked like a bunny slope. Think of it as a bunny slope, okay? Instead, by having delayed action, the peak is now much higher, and we have to bring it down far more dramatically and far more quickly. So we've gone from the bunny slopes to the double diamond, the black double diamond slopes. That's the cost of not having acted on this problem sooner. And, of course, there's all the damage that has been done by climate change in the meantime. So there has been a huge procrastination penalty in not have acting when we had enough information to act. That having been said, there still is time to act so that we avert the worst potential consequences of climate change. And we talked about the 2 degrees Celsius warming, 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit warming, as being a warming threshold that we definitely want to avoid, beyond which we really start to see some of the bad things happen. We can still avoid crossing that 2 degree warming threshold, but it's going to take concerted action. And what it's going to mean is that we have to very rapidly transition away from our current reliance on fossil fuels, on coal, on oil, on natural gas, and move towards solar energy, renewable energy, wind energy. We have the technology. The irony is that we don't have to invent new technologies to solve this problem. The technology already exists. We just have to scale it up. And there is peer-reviewed work, some excellent work done by folks at Stanford University, Mark Jacobson and his group at Stanford University, that have shown that we have the technology, we have the ability to wean ourselves from fossil fuels by mid-century, almost completely by mid-century. We have the ability to scale up solar and wind and other renewable sources of energy, and they're doing it. It isn't just theoretical. Germany is doing it. Germany is now meeting 30% of its energy demand from renewable energy alone. We are seeing dramatic gains made to the point where, for the first time in many decades, last year we saw global economic growth without a growth in carbon emissions. There is now what appears to be taking place, a decoupling of our economy from fossil fuels. We're starting to turn the corner, but we have to turn that corner even faster. We really have to dramatically incentivize this shift away from fossil fuels. We've got to stop burning dirty coal. We've got to massively deploy renewable energy.
The you talked about you kind of glanced off the economics of this. Let's talk about that. Fossil fuels
receive massive subsidies worldwide, from the actual subsidies to fossil fuels to subsidies like, you know, the American Navy protecting our shipping lanes to get Saudi oil here. But renewables produce energy more cheaply when you consider those extra costs, and that's not even considering the externalities, which I'd like you to address also. So what will it take to make the economics favorable for renewable energy to quickly overtake fossil fuels as a principal energy source around the world?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what we're seeing amazingly is that renewable energy is already making significant inroads in our energy economy, even without those incentives. Imagine what we could be accomplishing right now if we put the proper incentives in place. Because right now we have an unequal sort of playing field in the global energy market. We are, as you allude to, providing huge subsidies and incentives to the very form of energy, fossil fuel energy, which is destroying our climate, destroying, in some sense, our planet, and not providing similar incentives for the forms of energy, renewable energy, that can help us wean ourselves off of this dangerous, dirty fossil fuel energy. So the incentive structure right now is completely inverted from what it needs to be. I'm one of those people who thinks that the market can solve this problem. We can solve this problem in a market economy through market mechanisms, but the playing field has to be level. And right now, it's not level because we're providing incentives to the energy sources that are hurting the planet and not providing equal incentives to the energy sources that can help save the planet. Now, I saw just the other day that one of the Republican candidates for President, Jeb Bush, actually stated publicly that he thinks that we should do away with fossil fuel subsidies. And he was half right, because he also said that we should do away with subsidies for renewable energy. And that's wrong. What we need to do is do away with the incentives for fossil fuel energy and incentivize the clean energy sources that can help us avert this potential catastrophe.
Yeah. In fact, my understanding is that from news reports that the worldwide subsidies for fossil fuels right now are around $5 trillion a year. That would buy a lot of renewables. At this point, will we even know when we're seeing the worst outcomes, or has erratic weather simply become the new normal?
Yeah, the problem here is the variable tip of the iceberg, right? By the time you see the tip of the iceberg, it's too late. The Titanic learned that the hard way. So it is with climate change. By the time you are able to see in the day-to-day weather, you know, in the sorts of extremes that we've seen in daily weather, by the time the signal is so large that we are literally seeing it in the day-to-day weather, well, then you know that we've gone too far already. You know that there's much more in the pipeline, because it is, you know, to go back to that analogy, like the Titanic, the climate is this huge ship. It has huge amounts of inertia, what we call thermal inertia. The oceans can absorb a very large amount of heat, so the climate system warms up fairly slowly. It's burying some of that heat below the surface that's contributing to global sea level rise. So it is this slow but steady warming that will persist for decades. And in fact, if we stopped burning carbon right now, not only would the surface of the Earth continue to warm for half a century, probably give us at least another half a degree Celsius, but the oceans would continue to warm for centuries, and sea level rise will continue to rise for centuries. So what that tells us is that, you know, we have already committed to a certain amount of additional and potentially dangerous changes in climate. We are going to need to adapt to those changes that are already locked in. There's a certain amount that's baked in, a certain amount of additional climate change that's baked in, and we're going to need to deal with it. We're going to need to find ways to adapt to the negative impacts of that, those climate changes that are already locked in. But we can still avoid the vast majority of climate change if we act now. The most dangerous and potentially irreversible changes in climate if we act now.
This summer, the Pope convened mayors from around the world to address what cities can do at the local level. And small-scale renewable energy is being deployed much more rapidly than large-scale installations, at least from some reports I've seen. Is this how we have to address climate change from the grassroots bottom-up approach?
Yeah, and, you know, we see evidence of that here in the U.S. Right now, we have, there's obviously intransigence in the U.S. Congress when it comes to passing meaningful, comprehensive climate and energy legislation. We're just not going to see that as long as, you know, the politicians who were put in place by the Koch brothers in the last election through massive funding to put in place politicians who would be sympathetic to their agenda of climate change in action. Obviously, they now have a stranglehold on the U.S. House of Representatives and to some extent on the U.S. Senate as well. So in the absence of the potential for congressional legislation, what we need and are seeing is action at the executive level. And President Obama has pretty much done everything within his power to impose, you know, new carbon emissions limits on coal-fired power plants, increased fuel efficiency standards, again, through the EPA. You see states banding together. And my friend Jerry Brown, the governor of California, is taking a lead role in seeing that California is at the leading edge of introducing cost of carbon in their state economy, so that carbon emissions are now going to be priced to start to internalize the damages done by the emission of carbon into the atmosphere. And California is banding together with Oregon, Washington, and even British Columbia to institute a regional carbon emissions consortium. The northeastern states are doing something through what's known as REGI. Another regional carbon permit consortium are doing something as well. You see mayors passing measures at the local level, at the city level, to do something about carbon emissions. The mayor of Los Angeles, for example, is leading that effort. Philadelphia, the mayor of Philadelphia, Michael Nutter, as well, is part of that effort among mayors of the major cities to do something to act on this problem in the absence of congressional leadership. And, of course, there was this very critical agreement that the president struck with China within the last year to make sure that the two largest nations, the two largest emitters of carbon on the face of the planet, are engaged in efforts to bring down their carbon emissions.
Right. Dr. Michael Mann, it has been a pleasure and honor talking to you. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk with you as well.
And that's the big picture tonight. Don't forget, democracy begins with you.
Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
Okay, everybody, now we're going to jump right in here. The last 20-some minutes of Dr. Stephen Greer from September 17th, 2015 in London, ET Contact Disclosure and the European Connection. So, you know, we have the power. We have the power and we have tools. And the Galactics, they said, build it and we will come, and now they're here. So let's go. Come on here. E.T. home right here. Planet Earth. Here we go.
To document SSI uncontested from the mid-90s, 96, I believe, that states about creating a global UFO abduction cult for the psychological warfare value of it, using advanced man-made objects and life forms. So the Stan Romanek tape that I've seen wasn't released because Disney bought it up and took it off the market. Disney's always been in the back pocket of CIA. Yeah, since World War II, by the way. Absolutely true. I have a document that proves it. The fascinating document. It talks about a CIA document from the 50s, talks about Disney Studios making cartoonish movies about this subject so it would be ridiculed and be a laughing stock. So Disney bought up this tape, but if you look at it, It's this kind of, it looks like a typical gray. It's walking very robotically. And the man who, where it appeared in his house, had someone in the intelligence community that I think used to work with his father in the Air Force say, it's one of the fake ones. But the UFO and MUFON investigators and this gentleman had no idea what a fake one was. I said, well, in the 80s, there was research that came out that showed that there were these man-made, military-operated kind of androids that are nano-bio machines, so they have integrated circuits in their cerebral cortex. It's easy. You know, when Paris de Cuellar was kidnapped out of his limousine, UN Secretary General, in 1989, November, and they were planning, Gorbachev, Reagan, and Paris de Cuellar were planning to do a massive disclosure on the UFO subject. It got stopped. How did it get stopped? This rogue element within the intelligence community abducted him using those technology out of his limousine. Bud Hopkins thought it was aliens. Wasn't. I had a meeting with Prince Hans Adam von Lichtenstein, who explained all this to me. Now, he thought it was E.T. also. I said, no, it was alien, but not extraterrestrial. I used the word alien to connote the man-made scary stuff, because it's a xenophobic word, and the ones that are interstellar are called E.T. It's a little play on words. Very important distinction, though. And so Paris de Cuellar was told that if they didn't stop the effort to disclose this subject to the world, everyone involved, including the President of the United States, would be abducted. That was Papa Bush at the time. Not Reagan, I misspoke, Bush elder. And, quote, this blew up like an atomic bomb in the Bush White House. Now, Bush was a member of MAGIC, but MAGIC is not a monolith. There are these rogue elements who are doing this stuff. It's very complicated. We could be here till tomorrow morning. I couldn't get through all the machinations of this dysfunctional group. So that's why they know that we have got to educate ourselves about this, begin to make contact, bring this out. Obviously, the technologies they possess, you know, it could be done. But what effect would it have? It has to come from inside out. If it's for, and you know, there's a wonderful book that was written not long ago, a mainstream business book, about the distinction between power and force. And it's inversely proportional. Force is one-tenth the effectiveness of genuine power. So if it's forced, it never works well. Haven't we learned that in the last decade in the Middle East? Yes. Yes, sir.
Yeah. So
are you speaking? I can't hear you. Do ETs believe they have a God? Yes, I'm sure they understand that there's universal awareness, and they may not call it what we call it. They would be more of a Jeffersonian concept of a supreme universal conscious being. Yes, and you have a question.
Greenpeace is known worldwide.
I'm sorry, what's heard?
Greenpeace is known worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have any interest in zero-point energy?
No. In fact, the head of Greenpeace for Australia was at this confab in Australia and was probably the most hostile person to me there. Because they think they know what the problem is and all the solutions. And so, interestingly, the hubris that goes with that. Now, there may be other people in Greenpeace who'd be interested. I haven't found any yet, but this person was incredibly hostile to the idea that there would be classified technologies that would be a solution instead of windmills and solar panels. So, no, he was absolutely, and even though we were showing dispositive evidence and documents to the effect, but no, he would be very, very, very hostile. Now, I hope there are some Greenpeace people who would not be hostile. Yes, sir.
When you're meditating, how do you distinguish between what you're seeing as reality or just part of your imagination?
Yeah, well, this is a great question. When you're doing the meditation remote viewing, how do you know the difference between something that's objectively real and your imagination? You don't unless there's some external confirmation. So something that happens that confirms it. So in other words, most of the important CD5 events, there have been remote views on our team or lucid dreams where it's actually been seen and happened in advance. Does that make sense? Where we've actually seen the event. And then we'll actually go to that place. And then if it happens, then it's been confirmed. But many times you need some sort of external confirmation. or objective confirmation. So it's just one tool that's used. And the only way to get good at that is to practice it. You know, your phone rings, don't look at it, get a feel and sense of who it is. The doorbell rings, don't run and open the door, try to sense. So if you practice meditation enough, you'll begin to be able to do this. In the emergency department, I was a trauma guy, you know, I'd have people come in, and like this one patient I had came in with the flu. But I looked at him, as a young bloke like you, maybe 20s, and I looked at him and I said, oh my God, he's got a brain tumor. Two boys, two kids with him. And of course I turned to the nurse, who was this wonderful hillbilly nurse in North Carolina, and I said, I need a stat CT of the head. And she said, Dr. Greer, he's only got the flu. I said, just do it. Luckily, I didn't have to go through a bureaucrat or an insurance company or any other Nazis that run the healthcare system. Because in the emergency department, you order it, it's done. So we go in there, and he has this massive brain tumor that is an astrocytoma that's pushing his foramen magnum to the brainstem down to the opening at the base of the skull, giving him the fever, the chills, the nausea, all simulating the flu. He had no other neurological findings, none. The neurosurgeon said, how did you even think to get this CAT scan? I said, oh, I just had a hunch. I couldn't tell him. I had felt it and seen it. You know how they train golden retrievers to find cancers? Well, humans, I mean, I guess I'm like a big golden retriever, but I'm big and I'm furry, but that, it really is very effective. But you have to practice it and then get the objective feedback from reality. And otherwise, yeah, you just can stay in sort of something that can't be confirmed. I don't want to ignore this side of the group. Yes, sir, over there. White shirt.
Yeah, you mentioned the fact that the secret thought being legal. You mentioned that being legal.
Yeah.
Got a written constitution.
Yes.
In England, we have not got a written constitution.
Yes, but you still have laws.
Yeah.
And if the Minister of Defense, Lord Hill Norton, was telling the truth, and he was at the end of his life, there's no reason for him to lie, and I've met with many other people in your intelligence community and whatnot, who absolutely should have known. All right? And they're not informed. This is prima facie evidence of a project that is black, illegal, and et cetera. So whether it's unconstitutional or just flat out illegal, you can't be running amok if you're supposed to be in a representative democracy. I mean, that's something a totalitarian state can do. But you cannot do it in what's supposed to be a free society. So it's free or it isn't. I would represent to you on the important things it isn't. And that's the problem, that people need to rise up, not violently, and change that on a lot of things. Including, you know, there's this myth that we have a free market. Well, how can we have a free market if every significant technology since Tesla in the late 1800s has been ruthlessly suppressed, up to and including the killing of the inventor, which I know for a fact has happened. People on my team have been threatened. And so, you know, at a certain point, you have to realize this sort of a sub rosa fascism, as opposed to the overt buffoonish fascism of Adolf Hitler, has to be called out for what it is and changed. But it isn't going to be something that just happens by itself. Those folks are not going to give up that power. But in any of the representative democracies that are supposed to abide by the rule of law, these operations are, by any definition, illegal. And if they're illegal, the folks who are in those compartments, now usually these guys don't know. Because here's the nature of TSSCI, Top Secret Special Compartmented Intelligence. The one person has a little piece and another, and they're all in compartments. And the left hand doesn't even know the right hand exists. So what I'm saying is that we need to find people in those compartments and inform them of this fact. And say, if you've been involved in these operations, you are not bound by the security oaths, because those security oaths are also written into law, but the law itself has been vitiated by the programs that are breaking the law. So this gets into basic contract law. Let's say that, you know, this gentleman is a head of the mafia. I know you're not. And I enter into a contract with him. If he's running an illegal operation, that contract is vitiated. There's no enforceability. This is basic law in any country that has laws. Therefore, since that group is illegal, and this is what I'm calling for a mass defection from inside these operations.
another whole wave of disclosure, in other words, of mass defections, because it's too late for us to do it piecemeal. And they need to understand, if they do it, they need to listen to every word I've shared, that, and I will come to their aid, as I try to Gary McKinnon, who hacked into the Pentagon. Because while the act was illegal, the hacking, what he was accessing were projects in and of themselves that were illegal projects. And since they were illegal projects, they weren't covered by the law, including the hacking laws. So as I said, his attorney had it all upside down in how he argued that case. It would have been point set match if they'd said, here's our argument, it's a constitutional argument, and I would have given a list of people who could be subpoenaed. And these are, you get the drift of some of the folks. And that's why, and there are a lot of people who are victims of the secrecy. I mean, everyone has these conspiracy theories. You have Prince Charles here, very interested, and his father, Philip, very interested in this subject. And both of them subscribed for years to Flying Saucer Review that Gordon Crichton published, who was a military intelligence officer. And I know folks who are friends with Charles and have always asked for the briefings, like the presidential briefings I've put together will go to these folks and they'll take it to Prince Charles for these. But they are wanting to know because they're pretty much victims of the secrecy too. So a lot of people think there is a grand conspiracy, but it's not what most people think. And so you have victims, whether it's in royal families, in your military, in your intelligence, in your parliament, and in your 10 Downing Street over here. So that.
Talking about free energy, I heard that the Keshe Foundation, if I'm not wrong, is releasing a 0-point device that can power up your house now, like in September, October, this So I don't know how true this is.
Well, there are people that he's asking the question about these zero-point and so-called free energy. It's kind of a misnomer. None of them violate the laws of thermodynamics. You have to understand that it was proven decades ago by Dr. Casimir that there is a zero-point field, and it's estimated that a cubic centimeter of space, not outer space, the space in this room, has enough energy to run the United States for a week. Maybe a year, but a long time, and a huge amount of power density. So this has been proven scientifically in mainstream physics journals. The question is, can it be accessed? The answer is yes. Now, there are all kinds of things on the internet about so-and-so has one, and my group, the Sirius Technology Advanced Research, which is now the umbrella for the Orion Project, which does the energy research, CSETI, the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and the Disclosure Project, has a $100,000 award to anyone who can actually deliver something that we can then release open source. Cannot be patented, cannot have a trade secret, must be fully reproducible, and it would be released massively. And when I say massively, 800 million people saw the National Press Club disclosure event globally. This would be three times that. I guarantee it. But so far no one's come to us with something that meets the criteria, can be independently reproduced and tested, proven, only from plans. It has no secrets. Like Rossi has this thing, you all know, in Italy. National Security Agency contacts I have said they're very interested in it because they think it's real. The problem is he's keeping it a trade secret. It's going to be like Stan Meyer's water fuel car is going to go to the grave with him if he doesn't change his strategy. I'm making a prediction here. Anyone who tries to keep something like this and purely for monetizing it, and for a trade secret and patent, it's not like inventing an iPhone, a piece of junk. Apple. I mean, it's junk. I mean, it's made in a slave factory in China, $54 for something you pay £800 for, or $800 for. In reality, all that is very ordinary technology. You come up with something like this that's going to change the macroeconomic system, you really change something then. And so it can't be done in a conventional technology rollout. It has got to be open source, put out to the public. Now, this is very hard for inventors to hear because they may have put a lot of work into it. And they say, well, how can then I be compensated? Believe me, how many brands of Kleenex are there? Or Coca-Cola's? Or Xerox machines? Well, there's a zillion copier machines now. There could still be a way, and just like the, is it Linux, or the operating system, there are ways to do it, and there could still be a way to monetize it. But if you go to patent route, it's going to be seized. If you go the trade secrecy route, it will not be able to be replicated quickly enough before it gets hoovered up, vacuumed up by the intelligence community and squashed. And if you know, or worse, which, of course, there have been a number. We had a guy under contract in 2010 to build one of these over-unity free energy systems. And he had been cleared by the intelligence community to do it. Five of the shepherds, so-called shepherds in the intelligence community that were holding his security clearance, that says, yes, you can do this for Dr. Greer and the Orion Project. We gave him the grant. About the time he was assembling the thing together, he got visited by a former CIA director, the one I had briefed, R. James Woolsey, and a bunch of henchmen who threatened him and his wife and his family and shut it down. So he took our, he had our funds, and we got no system. This is why we're not going to do that. It has to come to us and be completely operational and reproducible. In other words, if you leave out the secret ingredient of how it works, which if you look at Stan Meyer's patents on the fuel energy water car, none of them are accurate. The voltages and the hertz, cycles per second, are all incorrect. He deliberately left out the magic of how it works, which of course vitiates the patent, but also means he took it to his grave. Except his twin brother Steve, who we met with, understands it, but he's afraid of being assassinated. Therefore, we either have to get people to fund an energy lab, because we really do understand how these systems work, but I'm not a mechanical or electrical engineer. I think probably, you know, I have a disc with several thousand patents that the CIA seized on a disc. We have it. But, you know, it's two-dimensional. To build it up is a research project. But it's in our vault. We have it. Anyone want to fund a lab? Got $10 million extra dollars laying around to open a research lab? Let's do it. I don't have that kind of money, but some people might, so it can be done. Or someone who, like these groups, have to bring something to us that we can then move across the goal line. If it's handled in any other way, it can't, you know, most of these end up being black boxes, these technology. And when you try to drill down on what is it actually doing, how is it working, oh, we can't tell you that. All right, and in which case it's either a fraud or they're strategically immature and they're going to go down. It ain't going to happen. So our strategy is to get something that is legitimate, can be scientifically tested, reproduced independently by multiple people, and once we know it's legitimate, boom, it's pushed out over the Internet. If we had our own laboratory funded, everything in that lab would be streamed in real time on the Internet. That's what we would do. And people want to come in and shut that down, or your own candid camera. Very, very big mistake. One more question, and then we're going to go in and just hang out together a little bit. Let's see, back here in the blue shirt, gentlemen.
Do you believe that there is a secret space program currently in operation? Do you have any particular thoughts on the Westmore and Cody Goons, who's been talking recently with David Wilcox about the secret space program?
Okay, in general, I don't talk about other people, but I will talk about ideas. It's just ethically I don't do it. I think it's important to understand that there is a secret space program. You know, by the time we landed on the moon with my uncle's lunar module, they already had 15 years earlier, anti-gravs that were flying around. Now, that is true. But then what happens is there are people who say, oh, yeah, and I've been to this star system and back, and those are great claims, prove it. So I need to either have multiple independent corroborating individuals and documents and et cetera for me to buy that. My understanding is that there are, in fact, a secret space force, but it doesn't go too far out there because the interstellar civilizations don't want it. In fact, I had a meeting not long ago, a couple years ago, with this senior naval research lab scientist who had come out of a briefing with a general at the Defense Intelligence Agency that had just been shown images of a massive interstellar craft out around near the rings of Saturn. And it was interesting, he didn't know that one of the executives at Lockheed Martin that was running the Cassini probe had called me to give me the same information. And apparently this space center is in the order of dozens to hundreds of miles in diameter. My military advisor for many years was at NORAD, North American Air Defense Command, and was in a Console 50, is what it was called back then, that tracked the interstellars and interplanetaries. And he said that at that time, back in the 70s, that they had tracked an object out in deep space that, in our solar system, though, that was 26 miles in diameter. I mean, that's like the whole diameter across the city of London. Floating out there. I mean, he said, his Navy guy, he said, floating under its own steam, moving under its own steam. I said, I don't think they're using steam, but Navy guy, you know, he's thinking steam. But so, yes, that part, you know, so there are interstellar objects out there, and there are man-made electromagnetic gravitics that can go a certain point. But my understanding is that we're not allowed to just go way out there. And the reason for it is that we're not considered civilized yet. If you doubt it, come to an emergency department with me in America on any Saturday night or whatever. I mean, it's not hard to figure out that until humans begin to live at a level one civilization that Michikaku calls a level one, we're simply not going to be allowed to go very far out there. So I'm skeptical of some of the claims. So, yes, we have a secret Air Force and a secret Space Force, but I think sometimes the stories get a little bit embellished and get too far out. Well, look, I would love to thank all of you guys for being here. You're a wonderful group. It's a little after 9. We have to be completely cleared out of the building by 10. So we're going to go to this other place. If you want to hang out a little bit, I can sign some books if you brought one. But we need to start moving in that direction. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Okay, we had quite a dose tonight, everybody. Thank you. And I'll just leave you with something. As I said, we finished our book, Buddha in Red Face, and we read a little piece of the books we read at the end of the Friday evening and the Saturday evening shows, just so you know when that's happening. And that's also transcribed and, you might say, added to our archives. And so the next book we're going to read from is called The Dalai Lama's Cat and the Power of Meow. And this is authored by a student of the Dalai Lama. His name is David Mishi. And the cat is like a chocolate point. And he's got chocolate face and all white furry fur Himalayan stuff, you know. Yeah. And he's got little chocolate legs. And so this is what it says here. This is just a few little quotes at the beginning. I have lived with several Zen masters, all of them cats. And that was written by Eckhart Tolle, author of The Power of Now. And there's one more here. It says, mind is the forerunner of all actions. All deeds are led by mind, created by mind. As one speaks or acts with a serene mind, happiness follows, as surely as one's shadow. And that was something that Buddha said. And there's a book that it's written about called the Dhammapada. And so it is. And tomorrow is another day, everyone. We'll see you there. And there's so much more. Let's keep awake, look up, and Nasara now, and Music Maestro. See you tomorrow, everybody.